Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cinema Joes, the podcast where three average Joes discuss the significant topics in movie culture. My name is Justin Mancini. I am one of your co-hosts here, and I'm very happy to welcome one of my other co-hosts. He is the podcast editor for thepopbreak.com, Alex Marcus. How you doing, Alex?
Happy New Year, Justin.
Yes, very happy to be back with you talking about some movies from the last year, and we'll be doing that, of course, with our other co-host. He is, along with me, the co-host of Podwork Angels, The Rush Hour, a podcast dedicated to the rock band Rush, Noah France. Hey, Noah.
Hello, guys. I am here, and I am excited to light this Mona Lisa on fire. That is the year 2022 in film.
I don't know if we'll be as cool as Janelle Monáe, but we can try.
I thought it would be impossibly high bar.
But we, as we've been hinting, this is actually an episode where we will be discussing the year in review. Typically, we do discuss a recent movie release and a larger topic related to that movie, but we are all about 2022 in this episode. And if you've been with us before, you'll know that we tend to break this down into different categories. So we'll be talking about our favorite big budget film, favorite small budget film, and for that we're actually capping it at $40 million, a budget of $40 million, talking about our favorite foreign language film, and also discussing our favorite performances from the year. But before we get into all that, I wanted to start, as we always do, by asking you gents what your general thoughts on 2022 were. And Noah, why don't we start with you? How did you feel about movies in 2022? What was the experience like? Did it meet your expectations? Were your expectations exceeded?
Well, unfortunately, I am still well below. Ever since 2020, the number of movies that I'm able to see, both new and old movies, has just been really hitting the crotch repeatedly, and it's not really recovered to where it was prior to 2020, where I was averaging seeing somewhere from 2 to 4 new movies every month, in some instances more than that. So I officially have 35 movies on my to seen list that qualify under my rules for my best of the year list. I'm going to wait until February to try and catch up a bit before I actually do my top 10 list. But looking back on it right now, though, it was a very good year. There's a lot of great stuff, enough that I can already tell that my top 10 is going to be, it's going to be a dogfight. It's going to be a dogfight to get into the top 10. The rankings that I end up picking are going to be a dogfight. And there's already some really interesting stuff that is not going to be on the top 10, but is definitely going to be getting, honorable mentions for me. So on the whole, like I'm looking back at the list and the quantity is not there. But the quality, especially the films that I really genuinely love from this year, is about as good as it's ever been, including a number of films that I think are either already or on their way to becoming some of my favorite films of all time. So on the whole, I would have to say I wish I could have seen more. I'm going to try to see more in 2023, but 2022 was a pretty good year.
Good. I'm really glad to hear that. I know that, you know, I'm kind of in a similar boat to you, Noah, where there's still a bunch. I feel like I still haven't quite tapped 2022 yet. You know, at this point for me, like there are fewer movies than I typically have seen from the last year. But I'm hoping to rectify that as we get into the beginning of 2023. And I'll just say, like, for me, I definitely felt like there were, just based on what I've seen so far, I have to say, I felt like there were a lot of films that either didn't quite live up to my expectations or maybe to their reputation. I felt like there were a lot of films I wanted to like a lot more than I did. there are a couple that come to mind, but maybe we'll get into some of them as we talk. And I also will say that there were several notable exceptions, including my number one film of the year so far, which I felt both met and exceeded my expectations, and also was really happy to get some really, really great films from filmmakers that I've wanted a great film from again, which I'm sure we're familiar with what that film might be. Anyway, mostly I will say it's a reminder that I need to watch more movies from this year. And there's still a bunch I'm very excited to see. I've been calling my list right now for what I'm planning to see. And, you know, it'll come out. I'm sure I'll get that list out in the next 2 years or so. But until then, it's just a reminder that there's much more for me to see. But there's still some good stuff here. And I'll definitely be talking about it. But Alex, what was your experience of 2022? I know you've definitely seen more films than either Noah and I at this point. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
Yes. Well, for one thing, I want to say you should give yourself a little bit of credit, because given how many 2021 movies you watched in the past year, the fact that you got to like around 40 something movies from this year is pretty impressive. And I have no doubt that you'll watch 100 more by the time we get to this time next year. I'm a little bit disappointed that I didn't get to watch a couple of key films that just were not accessible to me, including After Sun, a film that it seems like it's totally right up my alley that I have no doubt I will love, but didn't get a chance to watch that before this episode. Women Talking, another movie, Sarah Polley movie that Justin and I even made plans to see before we realized how limited the limited release ended up being. So unfortunately, we could not see that. Eternal Daughter, Corsage, Holy Spider, Return to Seoul, Saint Omar, and a couple of others. I really wanted to get a chance to watch before this episode, but couldn't. I did see 84 movies from this year, so I think I've seen enough to at least have a general sense of the year in film. And with that, I will say that there were two trends that really popped out at me that I was really impressed with. I would say that overall, this year is probably not as strong of a year in film as I would have liked. I feel like the last 2 years have been kind of like trying to get out from underneath COVID. And it's like, well, 2020 was a weird year. 2021 was a weird year. I really thought 2022 would be like the year where we're like fully back. And instead, it was a lot of good movies, not a lot of great movies. But something that was very interesting is that it was a great year for ensembles. This film year had so many fantastic ensembles that I actually made a top five list and I wanted to run through really quickly. Shockingly, Glass Onion, a fantastic ensemble, didn't make the list because that's how good of a year this has been in ensembles. But my list from 5 to 1 is Bodies, Bodies, Bodies at number 5. Underrated movie, fantastic ensemble. The type of young cast that we're going to look back on in 5 years and be like, oh my God, I can't believe all of these people were in this movie. Babylon, Damien Chazelle's latest, just an absolutely extraordinary cast from top to bottom. It's really a huge epic, and they fill the time with some really great performances in big and small roles. The Woman King, which I have no doubt we're going to be talking about more as this episode progresses. Fantastic.
Spoiler,
cast.
We will.
The type of cast that it's like, how do you even identify one performance or two performances out of, because they're all so strong. Similarly, The Banshees of Inisherin, just like there's literally not a bad performance in that. And maybe 4 or 5 of them are among the 10 best of the year. And then Everything Everywhere All at Once, which has so many actors doing so many different roles, all of the same characters in various universes, just top to bottom excellence. So those are my favorite ensembles of the year. I'm curious, before we move on, if you guys want to like toss any other ensembles, if you agree that this has been a particularly good year for our ensemble.
Well, I hear and I completely agree. Like all the, like most of those movies are in my list of performances that I wanted to highlight in our discussion. And I look back, all the names that I scribbled down, only one of them is an individual performance from a film. And even there, there's one, we'll get to it later. There's one performance I singled out that's the only performance from that film. All the other ones I have picked, it's at least two per movie, because in so many cases for me, some of my favorite performances are partially great because they're playing off of and working with or are mirrors to or opposites of equally great performances happening in the same movie. Yeah. OK, so another one, you mentioned your top five plus Glass Onions. I'm going to use this chance then to do a shout out to the girlfriend cast of Turning Red, all of whom are young kids, young performers, some of whom may go on to continue to do other movies and some of whom may never act again. And this will be their movie legacy. Turning Red is a film that is still, even though it came out at the beginning of the year, it's still in heavy competition for my top 10. And a part of that reason was just I adored and loved and bought into this gang of, you know, teenage you know, puke on the cusp of puberty friends and their whole dynamic to each other. And each of the voice actors from the main role, not both the main role and all the other friends around her, you immediately get a sense of who each of these people are, how they tick and how they interact with each other. And that, to me, that speaks to the fact that voice acting is every bit as a performative art as, you know, heavy air quotes, real acting. Yeah. So and that would be, oh, that's, also the one, great. That's the ensemble that I would want to add on to that list there for one of the best of the year.
Sandra Oh is also a great member of that ensemble. She was really right on the outside looking into my supporting actor list.
That is true. I had her on the cusp as well on my list of people I wanted to give a shout out to.
Justin, how about you?
I'll just give a quick mention to, so some of those would be films that I'll be talking about later. So I'm going to table those for now. I'm going to give a quick mention to Bros, which has a really great supporting cast that fills it out. People show up for like one or two scenes and they're incredibly funny. As good as Billy Eichner and Luke McFarlane are together, they have incredible people around them that just, I don't know, just like create this real sense of camaraderie and usually like end up like stealing scenes. And I just think, you know, for a film that I feel like maybe didn't get as much acclaim or at least as much attention from people, maybe didn't do the box office people were hoping for, I think that aspect of the film should be acknowledged. So
yeah, I think that Bros is definitely an acquired taste. I think Justin, you and I are in the top 1% of people who love that movie, but I'm glad that we both can agree on that. Another good queer comedy, a romantic comedy from this year, Fire Island, also had a fantastic cast that was just like top to bottom, hitter after hitter, so funny. In small roles and big roles. So yeah, that's another one that I would like to spotlight as like an honorable mention on the cast list. But
cool. Sorry.
But, oh, no, that's okay. Yeah. But the other big trend that I found this year was that despite this not necessarily being like the best year for kind of action movies or big budget tentpole movies, I thought it was a remarkably strong year for cinematic villains. So much so that I created a list of my top 10 favorite villains from the year in cinema. I'm just going to share with you guys now very briefly. I was very much on a list making kick this year, so I just had to honor that in the end of the year as well. Number 10 number 10 goes to Daniel Radcliffe for The Lost City, a movie starring Sandra Bullock and Channing Tatum. Not as many people saw, though it was a pretty big hit, but I feel like most of my friends didn't watch it. It's really funny, it's light, it's fun, it's like romancing the stone for a new generation. Daniel Radcliffe plays this tiny little rich man who just wants what he wants when he wants it, and Sandra Bullock will not oblige, and he's very funny in the role. Number 9.
I have to ask, is that the film that originated the meme of Daniel Radcliffe in bear slippers holding two guns?
No, that's a different movie.
Okay, all right. I just wanted
maybe
to check.
Guns Akimbo.
Yeah, that's Guns Akimbo.
Yeah.
But number 9 is another Daniel Radcliffe movie, a great year for Daniel Radcliffe. This is Weird, the Al Yankovic story. And that is, of course, Evan Rachel Wood, who plays Madonna in that movie and who is objectively the villain of the film. And she plays that hilariously. It's such a great Madonna performance and such a or an impression so fun what that movie does with her character. And she is just game from the beginning to the end. So I really, really recommend that. That's a Roku original film. And no, you do not need to subscribe to Roku to watch it. It is free on therokuchannel.com. Everyone should just check that out. It's kind of crazy that it exists, but it is perfect for what it is, which is a movie about Weird Al. Number 8, Christian Bale from Thor: Love and Thunder. I thought he was fantastic in the villain role. I think if the movie actually serviced him more, he would be much higher on the list. It's a great performance, but he just doesn't get really much to do. But in the couple of scenes that he has, he really makes an impression. Number 7, I'm going to say Ghostface in the most recent Scream movie. And I'm going to leave it at that because it's obviously, as with all Scream movies, a surprise to who Ghostface is this time around. But I will say that it was a very satisfying reveal. I think Ghostface is very effectively used throughout the film. And when you find out what's going on with that, it really It felt very prescient, very insightful about the current state of filmmaking. I'll leave it at that. Number six, Stephen Lang in The Way of Water, which where he plays the Avatar clone of his former self. Just like an incredibly game performance here. He is terrifying and sadistic and also weirdly compelling and almost a hero at certain points. Like, you almost want to root for him as a character, even though he also makes you sick in a lot of ways. It's a really, really great performance. Total motion capture, obviously. It's very impressive what he's able to do. Number five is Paul Dano in the Batman as the Riddler. This definitely didn't work for everybody, and I understand why. Because Paul Dano is definitely an acquired taste, but he is doing what Matt Reeves wants him to do so well and so perfectly. And that final confrontation scene with him and Batman in the prison, I think it lost a lot of people, but I thought it was utterly fantastic.
It worked for me. I do want to revisit the Batman.
It's great. You need to,
performance alone.
You need to like watch it over the course of 4 or 5 days because it is a very long movie, but it's worth rewatching.
So your next pick, of course, is going to be Colin Farrell from The Batman, right? Like,
well, I wouldn't necessarily say he was a villain in that film. I think that he's more of a sort of a interesting X factor, but Colin Farrell may or may not be coming up from me later on in this episode. But before we get to that, number four on my list is Tena Huerta from Black Panther Wakanda Forever, who is so charismatic and charming as Namor, as we've learned to say. And I can't wait to see him star in like a dozen other movies in the next few years. Number three, this is a little bit of a spoiler, but nobody's going to watch this movie, so I feel it's okay to spoil it. And also, when you see him for the first time, you know that things are not going to go well. And that is Mark Rylance in Bones and All. Truly an incredibly stirring and upsetting performance in that movie that really won me over to him as an actor. I was really on the fence as to whether he had what Steven Spielberg thought he had. And I don't know if Steven Spielberg thought he had this in him, but I'm certainly glad that he did. Number two, my favorite, my love, Elizabeth Olsen in Multiverse of Madness. Very contentious kind of choice to make her the villain of that film, but I think everyone can agree that she completely rules in that role, even if you wanted something different for the character. And number one, with a bullet, with many, many bullets, it is Jake Gyllenhaal in Ambulance, Michael Bay's Ambulance, a movie that is an incredible experience for about 40 minutes, and then you're just like, okay, I'm ready to get off the roller coaster ride, if you're me. But I never, never was not entertained by Jake Gyllenhaal, who was just completely out of his mind the entire film, from the second that he's introduced.
Will this be the first and only time a Michael Bay movie tops one of Alex's lists?
It very well could be. I mean, but like the second that he is introduced, he is given a 360-degree camera introduction with wind blowing in his hair, despite the fact that they were indoors. And he is just shouting exposition and character motivations in a very literal way, in the way that only Jake Gyllenhaal can. And it's like, if you thought that what he was doing as Mysterio in the Spider-Man movies was fun, or you thought, like, I liked what he was doing in Nightcrawler, but I want it to be like times a thousand, and then definitely watch Ambulance. It's incredible. At one point he's talking to a character in the movie with him, and he's asking her to do something that she very much doesn't want to do or think that she can do, and he says, well, you know what, I didn't want herpes, but that's life. And it's kind of the vibe that you're getting with that movie. I just, like, if you're talking about a character, an actor who is committed to a performance, it doesn't really get any better than that.
Wow.
For me, Jake Gyllenhaal will always and forever be Mr. Music.
Sure. It is a very similar energy to Mr. Music, honestly.
you almost sold me in watching the movie with that. Almost.
It's worth seeing. It's not going to top any list of your favorite movies of the year, but Ambulance is definitely an experience worth having. First, there's like three different sunsets in a movie that takes place over an afternoon, for instance. Like, it is just... it's just a wild experience, so it's worth checking it out.
Yeah, wow, I didn't realize there were that many villain performances, let alone like that many that you'd seen. So I'm very wow. Yeah, I mean, I like that. I like some of the ones that you pick. I mean, I really like the Mark Rylance pick. I'm definitely with you on that one. And I had a similar experience too. I was like, oh, right. Like when he showed up, I remembered reading that he was in the movie, but I was like, okay, how's this going to go? And I think it really works. I also like have to say his death scene, like I can still hear him. Like I can still hear him in that scene. He really
There's a lot of things from that scene that stick with me and will forever, I think.
Yes, whether you want to or not, I'm sure. But yeah, he does. I'll just say this. Mark Rylance does death throws very well.
Mm-hmm.
It there's to you nothing like coagulated blood.
Right, well, there is a lot of coagulated blood in that movie, let me tell you.
Yep. Not a lot left to the imagination.
Any other thoughts on the year in villains before we move on?
No, I think I'm good. I think you pretty well covered it.
I would say a quick shout out. I mentioned this to Justin earlier. This year had some absolute standout moments. This is not about villain performances, but this is about highlighting the moments of this year where we got to experience bad people getting their shit kicked in the most viscerally satisfying way possible. The highlights of which for me were the ship attack from Namor and his people in Black Panther 2 on what we basically learn is a giant covert CIA operation. And I mean, whenever the CIA is around, they're up to bad shit. So and which set the scene for that movie. All the French trappers going up against the Predator in Prey. Very satisfying. Very fun. The entire slave compound being burned to the ground in Women King. Ahistorical. True. But so satisfying to see a bunch of women armed to the teeth burning down a slave compound. And then, of course, Alex, our favorite, the whalers getting absolutely wrecked.
Yes.
In Avatar The Way of Water. There were multiple instances this year of bad people getting handed it to them in just incredibly satisfying ways. So
I think
that does tie together a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a nice little addendum to the villains that Alex brought up for sure. So guys, let's get into it. We're going to go into full bore into our categories now. And we're going to start with our favorite big budget film. And I'm really curious if we have any overlap here. I guess we'll see. But Alex, let's start with you this time.
Oh, okay. So I have two answers because I had number one and number two in this list, and there is approximately $350 million separating them. So it was in terms of what was the best big budget movie by our definition, which is $40 million. I would go with The Women King, which has a $50 million budget, which is just barely into the category. But I feel like that's not a good answer because I think what's so remarkable about that film is what they're able to do on the budget that they have. And they clearly feel limited in what they're able to do in terms of populating the sets and scaling the action and everything else. And yet they are able to create such a compelling epic of a film that usually would be costing twice as much money to make. So I also have to give a shout out to the true champion here, which is Avatar The Way of Water, which is $400 million. And every single cent is on screen in a pretty fantastic way. But I don't want to talk
that
about
is,
too
as
much.
We call it, a little bit of change was spent yes. on that movie. A touch.
I don't want to talk too much about either of those movies because, number one, we've talked about them before in future reviews. And number two, I think one or two of them might show up on your list. So I'll cede the floor and let you guys talk.
Okay. Well, I did not go with either of those, even though I was a big fan of The Woman King, less a fan of Avatar The Way of Water.
That's what you can hear if you listen to our featured review.
You can indeed. I'm actually going to go, I'm going to give some brief thoughts on one that we have talked about before, and that is the film Nope from Jordan Peele.
Okay, so tell us, Justin, what was the budget for that movie?
You know, I should have looked at that. I guessed it was over $40 million. I
caught
just
red-handed.
Wait, we can pause for a second and I can look it up.
Yeah, I'd be curious. I'm guessing it's over $40 million. I'm guessing 100 or maybe like, I would say 80
68.
To 100, I guess.
68. I had the Wikipedia page up.
68. Okay. 68. So close.
Okay. All right. So it was less than I thought. Interesting. So yeah, maybe not like a big budget movie in what we traditionally think, but certainly above what we're thinking. And I do feel like it feels like a big budget movie to me. as we've said before, this is a film about an extraterrestrial entity and its impact on the lives of Hollywood horse ranchers. It's so much more than that. I'm just going to give a little, like, sort of brief synopsis of my thoughts on Letterboxd, because I feel like there might be some things there that I didn't say on our episode. I really feel like it's genuinely terrifying in moments, but also there's no shortage of pure summer blockbuster thrills. I think you can really see that in the last act of the movie, where they're basically putting together this plan and then executing it, and things go wrong, and it's incredibly tense and exciting the whole time. I think the performances really leap off the screen with people like Kiki Palmer, and you have more subtle, though no less impressive, turns from people like Daniel Kaluuya and Steven Yeun. I feel like it's disturbing and awe-inspiring, both in the text, in terms of what actually we're seeing on screen, and the subtext, some of the implications that we've talked about in the episode about Hollywood exploitation, for example. As I closed out my Letterboxd review, I said, somehow it gets at the nuances of artistic and literal survival with no clean means to those ends. Someone's getting devoured. And I'll just leave it there.
Okay, Justin, bringing up Nope that way, you reminded me I have another addendum to my list of great moments in bad guys getting their comeuppance when the TMZ conspiracy person asshole runs into the, I guess, force field of the alien, and you just get this like Looney Tunes-esque as he like goes flying and just destroys his body and is then destroyed by the alien. Deservedly.
He was just there doing his job, Noah. He was just there to do a job.
Yeah, say what you will about him. He was committed to the end. He wanted that footage saved. It wasn't
I mean, you could say the same about the guards at Auschwitz, but
jeez.
I mean, maybe
I think it's a little different.
Sorry, I had to push that button now.
But Noah, where did you go here? Did you go with a true big budget movie? Did you go with something over $100 million, or where did you go here?
Okay, so I had a hard time picking this because it almost feels like we're gonna get into our favorite small budget film. It feels like whatever I pick for this is by default has to be my number two for the year, because my number one pick definitely falls below the $40 million mark, which is, I don't know, I'm not yet that confident in any single pick. So if I were to be forced to pick a film that had a nine figure budget, it would definitely be Black Panther 2, because that is one of my favorite movies of the year. And especially what I find especially impressive, first off, there are more and more subtleties that I grow to appreciate about film the more I think about it. And Justin, before we started recording, we were talking about one of them. Or actually, no, I mentioned it a while ago, the ship scene at the beginning, where we're introduced to these characters who are almost like within 5 minutes, they're all dead. But in those 5 minutes, we are given a tremendous amount of feel for who these people are. And we're given an understanding that these people have prior history with each other, and that they know each other, and that there's a dynamic between at least two or three of the people on this ship. And that's a remarkable amount of effort to put into a bunch of people who are only on screen for 5 minutes and are never coming back because they're dead. But there's a lot of parts of the movie that are like that, where there's a care and effort that honestly most people would never even notice. And just to top it all off, and this is basically a summation of what I said in our full review of it. This is an impossible movie. This movie should not exist, or at least should not exist and work as completely and excellently as it does, given the circumstances, specifically, most especially, the death of Chadwick Boseman and the insane production chaos that COVID and the pandemic brought into the mix. This movie should not work to the degree that it does, and the fact that it is a great movie on its own terms is something of a miracle. So that would be my pick for a nine budget film. But the one that I felt closer, that I still think is closer to my heart and will probably outrank Black Panther 2 in my list, and a movie where I was kind of astonished that it had the budget that it did, I went with Prey. As I said when I brought this up in the show, I did not go into 2022 thinking that a Predator sequel, prequel, that a new Predator movie would be one of my all-time favorite movies of the year. But Prey is one of the only movies that I made time to go back and rewatch despite my limited time, because it stuck with me that much. And that had a budget of, I was kind of, it has a budget of $65 million. So like more than The Woman King, which I don't know, it doesn't look or feel like a big budget movie. And I think part of that is because of the fact that it's so focused and so contained on this handful of characters and on the very basic survival struggle between these characters and the Predator. It doesn't feel like a big movie the way that The Woman King does. It obviously doesn't have the level of, even with the Predator and with the effects that you expect in a Predator movie, it doesn't have that level of in-your-face CGI that you expect from Black Panther, the Avatar, or, you know, Love and Thunder or Doctor Strange or any of the other, you know, major studio blockbusters. I'm going to talk about this movie again, just a brief spoiler at some down the line. So I think I'll leave it at that for now. But those are my two. So Prey number one, and then pick 1B is Black Panther, Wakanda Forever.
Nice. Yeah, I caught up with Prey since you talked about it on the show, and I agree. It's very impressive. I think probably where the budget comes from is, number one, you know, they did a lot of special effects for the Predator character. I believe that they shot a lot of it practically, and then at a certain point in the production, they decided to put a CGI kind of overlay on the character to kind of make some of the effect shots work better. But they also just have a lot of very impressive wide scope action sequences that I think probably were very expensive and intense to stage and to create, especially having it all be outside, not on sound stages. Like it had to have been very difficult to pull that off. And I think that despite the small scope in terms of it being an intimate story, I think it definitely feels like a very impactful action film that I'm honestly a little bit surprised that it doesn't have a higher budget given all of that.
I think that's true. I think that's a good way to put it. I was kind of flabbergasted when I looked at the difference between the budget for this and the budget for my pick for small budget film. But we'll get to that.
Yeah, I do agree, though, that this is a year that the budgets are so, like, there's no middle ground, really. There's just, like, gigantic budget movies, and then these sort of, like, movies that are just on the cusp of a big budget or a small budget. And so I like that you and I both kind of paid respect to that dichotomy by highlighting one of each, because they really do feel like one version of a movie trying to do what the other movie is doing, you know, but like on a much more limited scale. And in both cases, according to us, the better version was the less expensive version. So I think that's interesting to consider. And Justin just did the prompt as asked. So he just gave us nope. But I will note, interestingly enough, you know, we just talked about five movies, and four of them are movies that got featured reviews on our podcast. And we only did 9 new release films this year. So good on us for picking winners for our listeners, as it turns out.
That is the authentic Cinema Joe's quality right there.
Yes. And I'm sure we could have. Oh. I'm sure we could have talked about Prey, but we had to review Mrs. Doubtfire. So, you know.
Yeah, Prey is definitely on my list. No, I'm definitely seeing it before I do my best of 2022. So let's explore some of those smaller budget movies now and talk about which, you know, I feel like inevitably end up being, if not our favorite, then certainly in the mix. So I'm going to start us out this time, because I'm fairly certain this is not one that you guys picked, although I guess we'll see. I'm going to go with Tar. And this is one that I saw, I saw it in when it was doing its theatrical run, but kind of as it was leaving. And it was a really interesting experience in the theater, because I really felt like it was me and everybody else just seemed utterly baffled the whole time. And I just felt wrapped in this world, R-A-P-T. This is the latest film from Todd Field. His last film was 16 years ago. I think a lot of people pointed that out at this point. I actually caught up with his two other films, and I really like those as well. I probably like this the best of the three.
Give us the rundown. What are his two other titles?
Those are In the Bedroom from 2001 and then Little Children from 2006. Both were actually very much in the Oscars conversation. Neither won Best Picture necessarily, but there are a lot of acting nominations and I believe screenplay nominations as well. So this film is about a fictional composer-conductor, Lydia Tarr, who's played by Kate Blanchett, And the film chronicles an inevitable and precipitous downfall for this character with all the pieces laid out very beautifully from the beginning. And I think you especially see this in a lot of those long extended sequences. And Alex, you and I have talked about this, I think, because we both have seen this and are fans, about how a lot of those longer scenes actually are foreshadowing. And I think what's so good about them is you don't, at the time, you're thinking like, oh, this seems like kind of indulgent. It seems like we're spending a lot of time here. And then as you learn more about this character, you realize it's basically tracking things you're going to learn about her later. It's actually providing some foreshadowing, and it starts to all kind of click into place. And what I like is that even though the fall of this character seems so inevitable, like she is like at the top of her game, there's like nowhere else for her to go except down. What I like is that the craft is anything but inevitable. Like it feels very unexpected. You've got these like surreal waking nightmares that she's walking through. You got these hauntingly immediate scenes, and Blanchett is just titanic. That's the word I keep thinking of. Just the passion in her character, but also the performative nature, which just feels like it's all like wrapped into one thing, this one like self-destructive package. It's like she's so proud of this identity because she's cultivated it, and it's become her identity. It's subsumed in her, and it's almost like you can't tell where the person ends and the performance begins, which is something I'm a real sucker for in movies. I also just love how Field adjusts the pacing of the film. Like as the film goes on, we get less of those extended sequences. You get the shot length start to decrease. You get a lot more static scenes. It just really mirrors her downfall in a really satisfying way. And I just think the film itself is just haunting, but also very funny in the best ways. It's not funny in a like, you know, this is a laugh riot. Like, you know, it's not like a Mel Brooks kind of funny. It's more like you laugh in recognition. And I just really like, this is just one film that I keep coming back to. I keep thinking about it, and it kind of has snuck into my number one spot. I actually had another film there for a while, but I am going to rewatch it. So, you know, we'll see if the order changes. But yeah, I love Tar. I love everything about it. This was a film that I mentioned earlier that I just felt like I was looking forward to it so much. I was almost a little afraid, and then I saw it and it just, you know, really blew me away. So a very a lot of gratitude for me and for Todd Field and Kate Blanchett for really delivering.
And boy, we finally
got a trailer drop in theaters for this movie. So I think it is coming here soon. And it sounds like
a film that almost exclusively takes place in Germany should be out in Germany by now. It's ridiculous.
I know that's how this should work, but it's not how it does. That's yeah. So this sounds like the way you're describing it makes it sounds like the kind of movie that is especially worth seeing on a big screen.
Yeah, it's definitely a movie that you want to like completely envelop yourself inside of and just like give your full attention to. And yeah, I mean, Justin, you probably should have answered Noah's question, but Tar's my number two of the year. I love this movie. I think that you were so well articulate in how you were able to describe all of its strengths. And Lydia Tár is a genius, and I will be excited to attend her Carnegie Hall comeback when she gets it in about 3 or 4 years from now. And you know, I hope, Justin, you can be with me on that day.
Oh, I'd love it. But Alex, where did you go for a smaller budget film here? I have an idea, but we'll see.
Well, one could say I went everywhere, everything, all at once, because my answer is everything, everywhere, all at once. This movie, when I was looking at my list,
$14 million. How?
Yes. How? And in 19 days, they filmed this entire film in 19 days.
I did not know that. Are you serious?
Yes, I am serious. Yes.
Fucking how?
Right? It's insane. It's incredible.
Are the Daniels literal wizards?
They could be. Longtime listeners of this podcast may or may not know, because back in 2016 when Swiss Army Man came out, we did not have a podcast, but I was one of the world's biggest fans of that film. It still is, actually, the song from that movie is still my ringtone. I love that movie,
dude,
a lot.
Same here. It was my number two pick, and I like when I You guys saw this list when I did my 10th top 10 list this year. I went back and like did a ranking of myself, like which film of the year picks did I get right and wrong. Swiss Army Man had like, there's a legit argument to be made. I should have made Swiss Army Man my film of the year for that year, but I was too big of a coward. I was like, no, it's too weird. I can't do that. But it
is. That wasn't my number one in 2016, because 2016 is a pretty stacked year when it comes to great films.
It was, it was
my top 10 because it's a remarkable achievement, and it's something that I think a lot of people at the time kind of slept on. They were like, oh, the farting corpse movie, that sounds like a nightmare, who wants to see that? And I was just like, no, it's actually this incredibly profound story about depression and toxic masculinity, and it's really funny and sweet and amazing in all these different ways. You have to consider it. And everybody's like, no thanks. And so then
I have the soundtrack for that movie like on loop in my head, and if you listen very closely to the lyrics, because it's all a cappella singing by Paul Dano and Daniel Radcliffe from the directors.
Yes.
And there's one track, I have to double check which one, where if you listen very closely, you can hear one of them in the background going, "Everything everywhere matters to everything. Everything everywhere matters to everything." They were telling us right then and there what their next movie was going to be.
Yeah, I think that may have been satirical, but in any case, the movie that they ended up making as a follow-up, there was a lot of excitement around this movie coming out. I love Michelle Yeoh; she's fantastic, not just in movies like like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, but also on things that you might not know, like her extended arc on Star Trek Discovery. But I was very excited to see her paired up with this creative team. I was very excited to see what they would do. And when I watched it, this movie just completely wrecked me. It was such a funny and emotional journey. It kind of like has everything in it. And I was like, wow, that feels like it was made exactly for me. And I'm pretty sure that no one else is going to like it, but I'm happy that it exists. And then it ended up, topping a whole bunch of critics' top 10 lists. It's the front runner for Best Picture at the Oscars right now. So I'm very shocked to see that everyone has kind of fallen in love with this movie, but also not at all surprised, because it's a type of film that is so accessible, in that it tackles all of these like very relatable themes of, coming towards the end of to the middle of your life and feeling like you have all of these regrets and all of these paths that you didn't take, and what type of person you would be, what type of person could you be now, and how do you navigate all of that on top of the complicated relationships that you have with your family, and how those motivations push and pull you into being the person that you are and the person that you want to be, and how to resolve all of those conflicts within yourself and within your family. And it does that through incredibly irreverent experimentation in tone and genre and silliness that's all so sweet at the end of the day. And it's just an incredible, remarkable achievement that I just can't believe exists, and it's the only 5-star film of the year for me out of 84 films. It really just blew me away, and I am so excited that it's been so embraced in this fashion, and I just hope that we get so many more films to come from the Daniels and from Michelle Yeoh and the incredible supporting cast. As I said, it has a really fantastic ensemble as well. But yeah, this movie is fantastic, and it struck me that when we break out our top our categories of big budget movie, small budget movie, foreign language film, and it feels in a lot of ways that this movie could be all three of those, because it is explicitly
all three all at once.
It's exactly. It is explicitly a small budget movie, but it feels like $100 million movie. And it also is, a multi-language film, at least. It is definitely about the immigrant experience in America. So in that way, it is an American film. But it also,
I thought if I should be so daring and make this my pick for foreign language film. I didn't, but I heavily considered it.
I think ultimately that wouldn't have been correct, just because it really is an American story, and there is, it's at least as in English as it is in Mandarin, but it just is very funny. It's the nature of this film is that it is so many things to so many different people in a way that few films can really pull off. Like if you talk to 10 people who love this movie, they will give you 10 different reasons why, and all of them are valid and all of them are powerful. And there's not many films like that out there, period, never mind this year. So it's just a triumph, and I feel lucky to have been able to see it in a theater and to have seen it a day when I had a fight with my mom, so I could really feel like catharsis watching it. And it's just, it's a great movie. It's a great movie, and it's also notable. It's my favorite movie of the year, and that makes me 3 for 3 in years in movies, movie years, 2020, 2021, 2022, 3 years in a row where a middle-aged woman having an existential crisis is my favorite film of the year. So I don't know what this says about me and what I'm going through, but I have to. I just am so happy that I get a chance to talk about this movie again.
Okay, so this movie was also my pick, obviously, because I knew going out, this has to be my number one. Like, it would take an act of God to, like, remove this film from the top of this, and nothing else has happened. Like, my top five is going to be a tough fight, but, like, the fight's going to be over spots 2 to 5. I described Black Panther 2 as a miracle. This movie is a wonder. It is a genuine wonder at visual storytelling, at writing, at philosophy, it's a wonder at the possibilities of human creativity and of how big we can think, you know, with all the limitations of our body, just how big we can think just using our minds. And it can take us to places like this movie. Yeah, it's just it's hard to find the words to describe it. I've kind of I need to rewatch it. We're Stella and I, because Stella loved it too. We're trying to convince a couple of friends of ours to come over for like a group viewing, which is kind of how I would very much like to see it again. It's I don't know. Words are failing. I kind of, knowing that it was from the directors of Swiss Army Man, and also the guys who made the Turn Down for What music video, which is its own flavor of just beautiful, beautiful chaotic insanity. And then seeing the trailer, like I don't think my expectations could have been higher, even though I really try to keep my expectations in check at this point most of the time. But yeah, Justin, like you described with your film with Tar, like it didn't just meet them, it vastly exceeded them, and it succeeded at the same time at giving me more or less the film that I thought I was going to get, but at that time revealing just how limited my expectations were as to what that experience would be. It's great visual storytelling, it's a great ensemble piece, the script is great, the music is great. This cost apparently $50 million less than Prey, which is just blowing my mind. I still can't wrap my brain around it. It doesn't compute. So this is obviously my pick. So on that note, I would like to give a shout out to what would have been my second pick, and that is Martin McDonagh's latest film, Banshees of Inisherin, which came in at a budget of $24.8 million. According to Wikipedia, those are the only two films pretty much on my like top 10 contender list that definitely fell under the $40 million mark. And Inisherin, all I'll say about that for now, cause I think this is a movie that is largely made by its performances, and we're going to be talking about them shortly. This movie was such a relief because it felt like a return to form for Martin McDonagh. There was, like, In Bruges is still one of my all-time favorite movies. I still consider it the rare example of just a perfect movie, like a perfectly self-contained movie. Seven Psychopaths was interesting, but more like an experimental sense. I wouldn't recommend it to anyone as a great film, but I think it's worth watching and talking about. And then Three Billboards, I liked more than a lot of people, but I really do get where the criticisms were coming from. And it was another one of those cases where I was like, this is not the movie he should have been getting like mainstream recognition for. Like, he should have been getting this recognition for In Bruges. And I feel like the fact that this is the movie people are jumping on and giving a bunch of Oscars, like that's just kind of added fuel to the fire. So this felt like a return to form. Martin McDonagh is in his element, delving into pure Irish self-loathing, which, as someone whose grandmother's maiden name is O'Shaughnessy, I am all here for. Like, this is what he is good at. Irish people hating themselves and each other and finding increasingly creative ways to make their own lives hell. Like, that's what literally half of his plays are, just that premise, and they're brilliant. And of course, he remains the master of swear-filled insults.
No, what you feckin' talking about? I don't know what you're saying. This is a real funny, sweet
what
movie.
What I'm saying is, I'm feckin' boring, Alex. We're all feckin' boring.
Well, I will not attempt an accent, but I did just, at least not right now. But I will say I totally agree with you, Noah. I would also just add that doing all those things while still showing glimpses of humanity through it. That's why it really like is not just about like it doesn't just feel like a hate watch. It feels like you're really seeing human beings despite how over the top and convoluted their rage and their, you know, vendettas are against one another.
I fully agree. Yeah, no. I love this movie also. This is my number three movie of the year, if you must know. So definitely it's in high, high esteem by me. I think that it is all the things that you said, Noah, but it's also so sweet and so full of love in a really sort of confusing way. All these characters truly love each other and also hate themselves. And the way that that balances out is oftentimes being cruel to each other and also trying to be sweet to each other at the same time. And it's just it's a real remarkably nuanced portrait of humanity, as Justin said, that very few people can pull off. It's a remarkable achievement as a script, and the performers that bring that script to life are just incredibly, incredibly talented.
And it's like that for me, that was the driving spirit behind In Bruges, and what made that such an incredibly beautiful, that's what took In Bruges beyond just being, you know, a grimly cynical dark comedy, which it could have been content to stay at, but it's not. And as Justin and I can both attest, that's also the driving spirit behind the best of Martin McDonagh's plays. A lot of tragedy, nearly all of it unnecessary, but with enough indicators of, you know, the spirit behind that that makes the tragedy more devastating. Because you realize how unnecessary it is, but it still it lets you have that little sense of hope. You get that at the ending of The Pillow Man and the ending of In Bruges. And I don't know if all of his titles have such similar names for his plays.
Don't worry, I can tell you all of them.
I'm not going to make an effort right now to differentiate between them, but I'll let Justin do that.
Yeah, Justin is the Neil McDonough Martin McDonough expert on the staff. I'm the Neil McDonough expert on the staff.
If anyone is, yeah, it's definitely you, Alex. I wish I were, but you know, you can only just there's only so much time in the day.
you when you graduate from college, they say you're only allowed to specialize in one McDonough, and we chose our right. we made our choices.
Yes, that is the rule.
Yes.
Written in the book.
Well, guys, we've now been to Ireland, but I'm assuming we went to other places as well, because this is time to talk about our favorite foreign language film.
Well, Irish basically is a foreign language, so Banshees of Inisherin. All right, let's move on.
there are films in Gaelic, so yeah, you're not totally wrong. Alex, let's start with you this time. What was your favorite foreign language film?
My favorite foreign language film is a film by Park Chan-wook called Decision to Leave. This film is one of the most acclaimed foreign films of the year, so it's not really an original choice by me, but it is the first time I'm seeing a Park Chan-wook film, and I really, really enjoyed this. I was sold at this movie as being a restrained noir sort of film with a captivating central performance, and certainly the central performances are fantastic here. Lead detective and our protagonist, Park Hae-il, is really, really good, having to balance a lot of different tones in his performance. And you really feel like you're just like experiencing everything through his eyes in a way that he's such a relatable character, even in his flaws. And also the captivating supporting performance by Tang Wei, who I love from a variety of different films over the years. And this, she's so great here as a sort of mysterious femme fatale-esque character. But what I was not told is how funny and silly this movie often is, which was a real surprise and a pleasant one at that. This is a movie that does not take itself too seriously. It makes some incredibly bizarre choices in terms of how Park frames certain shots and creates certain set pieces that are unlike anything I've ever seen before, certainly in a detective story, but truly in any story. And it was such a great visual thrill to see. You really never knew what you were going to get next, but it all felt like a coherent piece. And there's some things that happened in this film that I don't want to give away because a lot of people still haven't seen it yet, but it is really a ride, an emotional ride, and a thrilling ride. The movie changes like three or four different times along the way, and while also managing to always feel consistently about a connection between these two characters more than anything else. And it's just whatever your expectations are, throw them out the window and just go watch this movie, and I think you're going to be delighted.
Yeah, that's definitely one I'm planning to catch up with. And I'm really happy to hear what you have to say about it having like silliness and, you know, not taking itself too seriously, because the two, I'm not a Park Chan-wook expert by any means. I've seen Old Boy and I've seen The Handmaiden, like two of his most popular ones. But those are like, those have like moments of just purely anarchic humor in them, in addition to, you know, loftier themes. And they feel like part and parcel of the same thing. So I'm really happy that this has this, that this film has that as well. So
yeah.
I'm honestly looking forward to it even more now.
Yeah, no, The Handmaiden was a movie that way too many people slept on. That's another, like, that's just an epic movie.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. I'm curious, like, I've heard some people were talking about it, making a lot of comparisons to Hitchcock, which is certainly not the first time Park Chan-wook his films have been compared to that. Did it give you any Hitchcock vibes at all?
Absolutely.
Is it kind of its own thing?
Oh, it has a very Hitchcockian quality to it in terms of both how it is extremely accessible to a mainstream audience, but also playing in those sort of psychological sort of tensions that are explored in those Hitchcock films. You know, it really feels like a Hitchcockian noir, which is a great kind of combination of things. But then also with all of these other elements that just are so wonderful and specific to Park Chan-wook. So
yeah, man. Yeah. Well, if there's anything he's proven over the years, it's his tone management is certainly one of his strengths. And I'm looking forward to seeing that here.
Like the actor Go Kwang Pai, who I'm not going to be talking about later. He gives one of the most one of the most effective comedic performances of the year, in my opinion. He's the main character's young protege, if you will, and he just gets a lot of really fun laughs along the way. There's one sequence where he's trying to chase after a man that they are in pursuit of, and he just cannot manage to get up the stairs because he is physically exhausted, and he just collapses, and it's very, very funny.
Very nice. Well, I look forward to all of that. Noah, where did you go for your foreign language film?
All right, so surprise, surprise, I am picking a Japanese animated film, and as it happens, I am going with the latest by Mamoru Hosoda, Bell. Now, the weird thing is, so this is probably my favorite animated movie of the year, and it's almost definitely going to end up in my top 10 list, but I would not argue that this is one of Hosoda's best films. Like, this film and his last film, Mirai, are both very, very good and just head and shoulders above most animated films that you would see in a given year. I still think the best trio films that he did are the films written by Satoko Okudera, The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, Summer Wars, and Wolf Children. I don't know why that is. Something about when he himself was writing the screenplay, I don't find the end product to be quite on the same level. That's not to knock Bell, though, because Bell is an incredible movie. In a lot of ways, it's a very weird inverse of Summer Wars, where the premise is we're in a slightly more futuristic time where there is a much more developed, like, online world. For most people, the reference point is going to be Ready Player One, which depresses me. But there's like this online world where you can log in and you have this digital presence that is theoretically completely separate and anonymous from your real life. And you can be whatever you want. And, you know, there are all these visuals showing all the crazy things and character designs and, you know, the colors and clothes and outfits and just the figures that people can take on in this world and their avatars. And you're going back and forth between the digital world and the real world, where you're focused on a teenager and her experiences both with this digital world and with her real world, and how experiences in this digital realm help this character to deal with difficulties and really some heavy trauma in her real life. So that's in both Summer Wars and Belle. The specifics of Belle is you learn that there is this figure who's become super famous for making pop music, and the songs they make for her are genuinely great. Like the music, this is some of the best music, original songs and score in any film that came out this year. So there's this figure in this online world, and no one knows who she is. No one knows the real identity of this person, whose music has made her into a big sensation. She's like the star of this online digital virtual space. And then you find out it's the main character is this singer. And in real life, she's actually a very shy and in a lot of ways deeply troubled and traumatized teenage girl, you know, working through some really heavy issues. And a lot of that has kind of been projected into, like, she can't talk or sing in the real world because of her issues. So she kind of puts that into her online persona. And through a series of circumstances that the film lays out in an early sequence, ends up becoming this huge viral sensation. But whereas Summer Wars, by the end, ends up being like there's this rogue AI that might nuke the world, and like all the people in the virtual world have to band together to figure out how to stop it. Here with Belle, and it's partly called that because there's, I think the character herself said that she was inspired to take that name for her digital avatar because she loved Beauty and the Beast. There's an entire section in the middle part of the film, which as one person somewhat critically referred to, like, basically is Beauty and the Beast, but just redone with like a Japanese anime style. That is very accurate. I can get people who see that and are turned off by it, but for me it worked. Whereas Summer Wars ended up being like kind of having a global threat and focus. Belle goes much, much more intimate, where through her experiences in this digital world, Belle, or this girl, I'm blanking on the character's real life name, meets a figure who's mysterious and very disliked in the virtual world. And she becomes convinced that there's more to this person than just this cold, like, cruel side that they show in the digital world, which is kind of at odds with, you know, how most people act in this digital space, which, you know, mirrors what we do in our own world in social media. And that's where we try to just focus on the positives, and our social media lives and our online lives are just portraying the positives. And here it's the exact opposite. And she tries to find a way to reach out and find out who this person is in real life and help them with something. I think whether or not that ends up working is going to be I think it will work for most people. There's some people who might find it a bit forced, because ultimately, at the end of the day, Hosoda is clearly really very, very optimistic about what a future virtual reality could do for humanity. And under current circumstances, it's hard to say that optimism is well-founded. Let's put it that way. So I think that there are a lot of people who could watch Hosoda's movies that touch on this topic and are like, that guy's smoking the pot a little bit too hard. And I can get that criticism. But it does lead to to some really powerful emotional moments that end up carrying the weight of the film through the end. So that's Belle. That's my pick.
Very good. That movie is a little bit of a tweener in terms of whether it's a 2021 or 2022 film. Now, it was released in Germany exclusively in 2022. So that alone gives you a pass. It had a qualifying run in LA only in December of 2021, but then was given a limited release in the United States and then a wider release in the United States in 2022. I mean, so
Los Angeles is such a tiny, inconsequential market. I really don't count that.
Truly. The sad thing is that it means that it's not eligible for the Oscars this year, which is unfortunate because, you know, this is kind of a mixed bag of an animation year. And this film did get tremendous reviews from people who saw it. And I think it did better business than people were expecting when it got that limited release. And it could have been an outside chance of getting the nomination, at least.
But to be fair, I am so beyond worrying about that. The Oscars have done right by animation twice, maybe three times, and the rest of it is just a shit show. So I'm long.
It's weird that that's the problem for the animation branch, because outside of that, Oscars gets it right all the time, every year. So.
Yes, of course.
Exactly. I've seen this as well, Noah. I would say I'm probably not. I do like this movie. I didn't like it maybe as much as I wanted to.
Have you also seen Summer Wars?
No, I haven't. I've seen.
I do think I really like Belle, but I do think Summer Wars is the better version of that story.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, that's definitely one I'd like to catch up with. I've seen some of Hosoda's other movies, like The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, as you mentioned, The Boy and the Beast. I'm a really big fan of Mirai. I really like that one a lot. That actually did get an Oscar nomination.
I
did
not win, but. Yeah, I liked it too, but like I said, Girl Who Leapt Through Time, Summer Wars, and Wolf Children, those are the three that kind of stand out the most for me. The only film of his I have not seen is his first feature film, which was one of the, like, 20 One Piece movies, which One Piece is great, but
yeah,
there are too many movies. I'm not going to make the time to see all of those.
Right, yeah. But yeah, I did like Belle. I would say, similar to some of his other movies, maybe, it is that last act where it started to lose me. And I guess it wasn't so much the discovery, like the revelation of who the beast was. It was more just like how the story of the film tried to pull everything together, like tie all the strands together. I just felt like it really started to stretch credulity for me.
Summer Wars and this both pull that. And I think in both cases, people can walk away saying, no, that's too much of a stretch. I can't buy that. I'm out. And I can understand that. I think Summer Wars does it better. Mm-hmm. I think Belle, it worked for me with Belle, but I can see it not working for other people. That doesn't surprise me.
I mean, and I will also say, just, it really does bring together, I think, the best of two-dimensional and three-dimensional animation. And I think that's really key to what makes the online world feel so real. And I think that's something that, you know, there's stuff that I'm seeing, like, has this ever been done in animation before? So...
It is definitely infinitely more interesting and visually engaging than the online world in Ready Player One.
Yeah. So
like, this is what Ready Player One wishes it could be.
I would agree there. Hosoda is one of those guys that, like, I'm always interested in what he's putting out. He hasn't quite become like a beloved filmmaker for me yet, but I'm always interested in like what he's doing. And I know that he's always going
to continue. He's yet to make a bad movie.
Yeah.
But Justin, cool. What was your choice?
So I went, I realized a few days ago, I'm like, I don't feel like I have a good foreign language film to talk about. I need to see a couple more. Might as well get an early jump on the films I will inevitably see. So I've been watching a few more foreign language films. And the one I really want to talk about is called Hit the Road, which is from the filmmaker Panah Panahi. And if Panahi sounds like a very familiar name to you, you're not mistaken. This is Panah is actually the son of Jafar Panahi, who I've mentioned, I believe, before on this podcast, who is currently imprisoned in Iran. But what I like about this movie is that even though, you know, you've got that kind of family connection with this, you know, internationally venerated filmmaker, Jafar Panahi, I think this film is proof that great work transcends any family connections. I was thinking a little bit, even though it's a very different style, but I was thinking, like, you know, people don't really talk about, they don't compare Sofia Coppola to Francis Ford Coppola, do they? Because she's kind of like forged her own way.
I'm sure they did at first. I'm sure she had to work a bit to get out from under that shadow.
I don't know. Virgin Suicides is such a different movie from anything that Francis Ford Coppola made.
Right.
That I think it just like immediately set her apart.
Yeah,
there, she got a lot of like, she only has this position because she is his daughter, but she didn't get compared creatively to him pretty much ever, I don't think.
Yeah. And I seem to see, like, it seems to be somewhat similar with this movie. There seems to be like it, like the attention seems to be paid to the movie itself, which the movie is good enough to do. This, of course, is about an Iranian family. They're driving this rented car to the Iranian border. It's not quite clear why, and then they kind of explain it, but we learn that that was actually a lie. It becomes clearer what is happening, but doesn't ever give you the full story. And I feel like by doing that, you're keeping this mystery of the film. So it makes the tensions that arise between the members of this family. So it seems like it's not just derived from this current situation. It's almost like this has been a recurring thing in the family well before this event that gave rise to this road trip ever occurred. And I will say, for those who are seeing this, you might have a similar experience to me, because I've seen other people have this experience where you're watching it for about the first half hour. And it's very busy. There's a lot of incidents, very quirky kind of family, somewhat dysfunctional, but also kind of lovable family. You're kind of like, okay, this is interesting. I don't really know where it's going. I don't really know what the intention here. And there's one moment where all of a sudden you just get hit in the gut. And it was from that moment on, for the next hour, I was just with this movie and with these people. And it just all kind of clicked. So I really encourage, if you're in that first half hour like I was, thinking where is this going? It seems interesting, but doesn't seem to have a point. There's a moment. I don't know if it'll be the same for everybody, but it really hit me. And all of a sudden, all that quirkiness, all that stuff basically fell away. And I was really hit with the emotions of these people. And I just think it has such a great sense of history to the family. I really love the ways they have of expressing love for one another that aren't direct. You can tell this is a family that has a hard time saying, I love you. I don't believe they ever actually say it, but it still comes through in the performances. And this is one of the ones I probably would have mentioned before, Alex, when you talk about great ensembles, because I really love everyone here. And I just think it's just so undeniable that this has just been a family that's existed before we ever see them on screen.
And it's pretty much just them, right? It's just the family as the cast.
They do meet some people along the way. It's very much it feels like a road trip movie. But they're not major characters necessarily. It's mostly centered on the family itself. I will also say, where this film ends up, there's kind of you think it's kind of ending, and there's an additional scene, and it could be very jarring. But I would just encourage you in the past day or so, as I've thought more about it, it makes a lot more sense. I can't really give it away because it kind of is, you really have to kind of see the movie, but I think it makes a lot more sense. And it really, really shows you that this is a family that is going to continue to encounter struggles, and they'll get through it, but there are going to be struggles. And I think that's just, it feels like a more realistic ending than, I think a lot of other films that just end in a kind of ambiguity. This has a little bit more clarity at the end, and yet it still feels complicated. And that's really a remarkable thing to pull off, in my opinion. So I really love this. I think it's going to be, if it's not my top 10, it's definitely going to be an honorable mention. And I just encourage people to see it. Even if you've seen, Jafar Panahi's work before, I have not seen a ton. I've seen Taxi Tehran, but I know a lot of people really love his work. I would just encourage you, even though it's, it's his son, just take it as its own film. And I think you'll really be impressed. So I really want to recommend this one.
I have to say, your Letterboxd entry on this was the first time I had ever heard of this movie. But hearing you talk about it in more depth makes me very interested in it. So thank you for bringing it to my attention.
Yeah. And I should mention, even though I've been saying to focus on this film, Jafar Panahi does have a movie that came out in 2022, which I will be seeing at some point. I believe it's called No Bears. So I did just want to mention that as well.
I have to say, every time I see the title of that in my head, I hear No Dames from, the Coen Brothers movie. Hail Caesar. Yeah. So it's a throwback musical.
Is it the inverse where they're singing about no gay men in San Francisco?
Yeah, well, let me tell you, that group of gay guys definitely could have also been singing No Bears, let's be real. But
that talk about a movie I gotta rewatch.
Would recommend.
Underappreciated treat.
Before we move on, I did want to say, there are four movies that would have been considered for this that I didn't get to see that I've heard really great things about. Corsage, Holy Spider, Return to Seoul, and Saint Omer. I'm really excited to see those, and hopefully they end up, if not better than Decision to Leave, then at least on par with that. That's my hope. And I feel like we would also be remiss not to mention in this segment RRR, which is kind of like the international sensation of the year. Outside of my top 20, it's number 36 on my list on Letterboxd. I thought that it was, I get why people really like it. I think it's certainly a lot in all of the good and bad ways that a movie could be a lot, I think. Not quite for me, but definitely I'm excited for its success, and I could totally tell why people love it as much as they do. I think, Justin, you liked it even less than I did, so I'm not surprised to not see you highlight it. Noah, have you seen this movie?
No, I have not. Although I have seen, I mean, I saw two other Indian or Bollywood movies, Bada Do and, I have to double check the title to make sure I'm saying it correctly, Brahmastra Part 1, which is apparently going to be the first part of like a Bollywood Avenger-style trilogy, with the Avengers being like all Hindu mythological or powers based off of mythological Hindu creatures and symbolism. And that was a movie where Stella and I were the only white people in a very packed theater watching it, like in the original Hindi with subtitles. And like when each actor appeared on the screen at the for the very first time, in one case, it was literally a woman opening a window. The entire crowd went nuts and started screaming and cheering and clapping. It was an experience.
So that's cool.
I can only imagine if I saw RRR under those circumstances, then the windows would have like shattered in a 10 mile radius.
It does seem like people who had the opportunity to see this in theaters liked it considerably more than you may expect them to have liked it. So I definitely think that this is the sort of movie that has helped with a crowd. It's notable this is not a Bollywood movie, even though it is from India. They do not speak Hindi in the film. But it's not part of the kind of Bollywood industrial complex over there. So notable film, even if it didn't top our lists this year.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so let's go to our last category. This is where we talk about our favorite performances, and we have mentioned a few of them before, but here we're really getting into some of our favorites. I'm actually going to start this time just because I probably have fewer people to talk about on my list, and
Let's see if any of yours are on our list, and then we'll sort of go from there.
I'll be curious about that. I should explain what I like to do on our podcast for this category every year is try to talk about performances that I think are not going to get as much attention with specifically with like award shows and that kind of thing. So I've tried to spotlight people that you guys may have seen some of these, and I think I'm pretty sure you both have. But I feel like these are ones that maybe awards bodies are not going to really give as much acclaim to. As much as I love, you know, Cate Blanchett and Michelle Yeoh in their respective films, I did not have them at least here to talk about.
And listeners of our podcast from last year, if they were dutiful to Justin's recommendations, they would have had the inside track on Morfydd Clark before she became Galadriel in Lord of the Rings and took the culture by storm. So, you know.
Yeah. So I'm going to start with so the performance that I wanted to highlight from this year, and I was looking through my movies and it was like, which one of these was like a performance that I couldn't take my eyes off of, that was like completely magnetic from beginning to end, and I just like really was just held in complete thrall to. And for me, that's Zoe Kravitz in Kimmy. I just really love this performance. I feel like it's a real movie star performance, and not just a movie star performance like for our time, even though so much of it feels like now. I feel like it's just a movie star performance, period. And for those who have followed our podcast, you know that we've talked about her in The Batman. If that wasn't enough to convince you, I think this is enough to cement that she is a legitimate star. She just gets so much to do here. She's playing this woman, Angela, who has developed agoraphobia after this traumatic attack that she experienced that we don't learn like the details of, which I'm kind of glad we don't, because I think it puts more emphasis on her and less emphasis on the incident itself. And what her character experiences as part of her job, she hears this recording that she realizes may be a murder. And she's playing someone here who is hyper aware of her surroundings, but also doesn't always reveal her feelings about them. And so she gets to play all these different things. She gets to play paranoid. She gets to be caring. She gets to be fearful, courageous. And even at the end, she gets to be an action star, almost this like little mini action movie for like a few minutes. And she just carries it off perfectly, in my opinion. She's the kind of like, she's just like the kind of character that you just want to like reach through the screen and like just give this like big hug to, because she's going through so much, but she's also so up to the task. And I just feel like she pulls off that balance really well. And like I said, I think, in my opinion, if the world were fair, this would be the thing that really turned her into a star. And I was really happy to, you know, I was just really happy to see her do this, because I've liked her for a while. And this was really something that was like, oh no, I'm like a big fan now.
Yeah, she's excellent in this movie. I'm so glad that you saw this movie and liked this movie. I feel like a lot of people slept on this movie when it came out. It was like a directed HBO Max release. And I don't know. I think that the people who did see it, I saw a lot of reviews that were just like, yeah, it was okay. It was like fine, like genre exercise, whatever. I think it's so fun. I think it's so well executed. And I think the entire thing revolves around her performance in a way that you just, if she's not as good as she is, the movie just falls apart. And she is. So excellent, excellent choice. I love this choice. I will reveal a little bit about my lists of performers of the year, and to say that I have a category for best performer with multiple great roles, because there were a number of them. And that was also a way for me to highlight more people in my other lists. And Zoe Kravitz for this and The Batman definitely made that cut. So
great. And just some very quick honorable mentions, other people that I think deserve some acclaim from this year. Tar had so many good supporting performances. I know it's easy to just talk about Kate Blanchett, of course, but man, there were so many good ones. I really liked Julian Glover playing this like older professor type who was one of her professors. And I think there's a lot of interesting history between those characters, again, which is not very spelled out, but just a really lived in performance. People may know Glover from playing Pycelle on Game of Thrones. He's been in so many things. He was in Indiana Jones: The Last Crusade. Really good to see a performance from him here in such a good film. Lashana Lynch in The Woman King. So many great performances in that movie. Again, no bad ones. I just love how fun that character is, and I just love seeing that from Lynch. Like, I feel like she's been very good for a while, but I feel like we haven't really seen a lot of her more comedic chops up to this point, and it's really good to see that here. Bodies, 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 which you recommended before, Alex. There were so many people I could talk about here. I just really like Lee Pace a lot. Like, he's just incredibly funny, but also sinister when he needs to be in, like one scene. I just really love everything he's doing in that movie, and it's kind of a shame when he's no longer in the movie, even though I understand why it needs to happen. Rory Kinnear in the film Men, I guess kind of a villain role, but he's playing so many roles, sometimes in the same frame. So he's doing a whole lot in that movie. There's a lot about that movie that doesn't work. There's a lot that does. I feel like his performance is like the one consistent thing in it that I would recommend anybody see. If you're going to see it, he's a good reason why. And last but not least, in another film that I've heard some people talk about as a really good ensemble, and there's some great performances in it. I was a little maybe cooler on the film. It seems like a lot of people were. The film The Menu. Hong Chau, just every single scene she's in, and it's a smaller role, but man, she's just like so controlled that everything she says, even when it doesn't seem like it should be imposing, it is. And she's just so great in that. She's one of those people that I think probably should be a movie star at this point. She was wonderful in the Andrew Ahn film Driveways. You mentioned Fire Island before, Alex, she's really good in that. She was great in The Watchmen show playing an antagonist. I think she can really do a lot, but I also think this is a really fun role for her as well. And I hope that she gets bigger roles coming up. That would be my hope. So I just wanted to mention those folks. I'm curious, did any of those people come up for you guys? Or
yes. So I would like to take this. I'd like to dovetail on one of your honorable mentions and Lashana Lynch in The Woman King. Great cast start to finish, just top to bottom. Viola Davis really carries, the titular role. I love what John Boyega is doing in this side role of, you know, this king who's just kind of cool, really. That's kind of like what his role is. He's like, yeah, more quality for women soldiers that protect me. I'm down with it. Don't talk smack about my ladies. It's just it's a nice little role that he has there. But no, Lashana Lynch, man, I may be deeply, seriously in love with Izogi because she is so cool, so funny, so confident, and her eyes, like, I could not look at anything else when she was on screen. Like, literally, physically, I could not look anywhere but into her eyes. Like, that is how hypnotizing her performance is in this movie. Which makes it all the more impactful later on when her character, you know, really kind of gets kicked in the shins, so to say, by circumstances and is really down. It's a beat that you can, there are a lot of storytelling beats in The Woman King that you can maybe see coming, or you can maybe guess, like, oh, okay, this is going to happen to this character and this will happen to that character. So there's a lot of stuff I feel you can kind of, just on a purely narrative level, you can see coming. But part of what makes The Woman King so great is that it doesn't matter even when it's a little formulaic, because it's doing it all so well. And just her, Lashana Lynch's performance makes you feel so and love her so much. It makes it even harder when you see her down and unsure of herself and not sure what to do next. That's like a horrifying moment. Even if you could have seen it coming, that doesn't prepare you for like the experience of it. And that makes it that feeds into the emotional experience of watching the rest of the movie, up to and including an army of women armed to the teeth burning down an entire slave compound, which, yes, I've already highlighted that.
I've also heard that Lashana Lynch is quite good as Miss Honey in Matilda the Musical, which you can watch on Netflix. I have not seen that, though.
I do want to watch that. I haven't seen it yet. But her presence and also just the snippets of dancing look really, really good. Those kids look like they're having the time of their life. I think that's probably going to be a good time. I do want to watch that. So that was one of the three that I most wanted to highlight. The second one, and this is a movie that Justin, I think you've already said you have not seen, but Alex has. And that is Prey, the new Predator movie, and specifically the main female lead, Amber Midthunder, who is herself Native American. I think the entire cast, except for the French trappers, obviously, and the Predator is obviously not Native American. But all of the Comanche tribes people in this movie are actual Native Americans. So I guess not all of them, maybe not all of them have Comanche heritage, but they did do, the cast did a Comanche dub of the movie, which I made it a point to see again, you know, just to give an extra click to that and support that. She is just... you buy her immediately. Again, like the Prey is a very simple, concentrated movie. It's not doing anything groundbreaking narratively. Young woman in still, you know, very patriarchal, you know, system and time, wants to prove herself as a fighter, not taken seriously by the men around her. But then the Predator shows up and that's her chance to prove her stuff. Like, that's basic stuff. We've seen that before. But Amber is, she just comes in and you immediately get it. You immediately get her character. And she is tough, like she's tough as nails, and is obviously a really skilled fighter. But you get the sympathy for her. You see the disadvantages that she's facing, and you would just immediately want to root for her even before the Predator comes up and starts killing people in creatively horrific ways. And it's even like, it, like, the original Predator is a classic for a reason. I think it's a great classic 80s, or I guess early 90s. When did it come
80s.
Out?
Is it, okay. It's 80s, yeah.
Classic 80s Schwarzenegger movie. But this is a much different vibe than Arnold Schwarzenegger, who, like, the movie establishes this is, like, the strongest, most powerful human being in the world. And, like, Midthunder is just, or her character's name is Naru. She's just another girl. Like, she's obviously well trained as a warrior, but she's not like a Marine. She doesn't have any like super strength or anything like that. She really just has like her basic survival skills and her wits. And what I think makes Prey so compelling is the fact that they combine. It's not just her fighting skills, which, you know, you see her, you know, developing a few new fighting techniques and things like that. But it also establishes that her knowledge of the land, her ability to track, her knowledge of herbs and healing, and techniques all come together to allow her to, you know, stand up to and take on and take down. I don't think that's a spoiler. We know how Predator movies end, that allow her to stand up to a Predator. And she really sells that. I do want to give an honorable mention, though, to Dakota Beavers, who is her brother. It's a smaller role. And again, because it's a Predator movie, you kind of assume, OK, anyone who's not the main character is probably, you know, Predator meet, and Yeah, I mean, spoiler, that's not any different here. But still, he's so, he has such a great back and forth dynamic, and he's not like a mean older brother. He is somewhat dismissive, but in a way where like you can understand why he is that way, and it's not done to make him an asshole. There are other characters in the tribe who are very clearly just there to be assholes. But he's like, you get why he's doubtful or why he's skeptical and how he's trying to protect her. But he's able to learn and realize, you know, when shit hits the fan later on, like, okay, no, you were right. This is something we've never faced before. We got to work together and figure this out. And it's really like with the limited amount of time he had, it's a really affecting performance. So then the last role, and then I think we'll move on to Alex, because Alex, I assume a lot of the people on your list are people that I also wrote down as well. I assumed that at some point we were going to talk about Brendan Gleeson and Colin Farrell in Banshees of Inisherin, which, you know, amazing dual performance. They bounce off each other so perfectly. Like, their dynamic is what makes In Bruges so much fun. And that's another way that this feels like a return to form for Martin McDonagh. But I do want to pour out a sherry for Kerry Condon, who does it's this is one of those performances that I feel gets so overlooked so much and is almost never talked about when it comes to like awards. This is the kind of the performance that you just don't see nominated for awards or getting that kind of buzz. But it's absolutely essential. She's not doing anything big or flashy, doesn't have these huge emotional moments. But she plays this incredibly important role of basically being the only sane human being on the island of Inisherin. Like, she is the one audience POV character who has her head just a little bit above the mud and is able to say, in one scene, literally saying, "You're all so feckin' boring." And, like, it's true. I mean, I wouldn't say the characters are boring, but they are all fucking insane. And she's the only one with, like, a level head on her shoulders and a sense of, like, no, this really isn't that important, people. Like, there's bigger stuff going on in the world. You know, you don't have to, you know, fight each other for scraps and throw your fingers at each other. Knowing McDonagh's penchant to do terrible, terrible harm to people you've been made to sympathize with, I was kind of afraid the whole movie, like, oh, God, is she going to get raped or assaulted or murdered? It doesn't happen. She makes it out. It's like,
she's the only one that makes it out, in a sense.
She's the only one that makes it out. She's the only one I wanted to make it out. The rest of them deserve each other. But Kerry Condon got out. She got to run her little library. I hope she's happy somewhere in the mainland.
She escaped into the Civil War, which is a fun detail of that movie, where it's like their life is so like sealed and just like hermetic that like going into an active war zone is considered like a relief, an exciting new adventure for this person.
And I don't feel that she's in danger. I feel she can handle herself on a field of combat. On that island with that policeman, she's not safe.
Yeah, that, oh man, that guy.
So those are the three performances that I wanted to highlight the most. I have some other names written down, Alex, but I'm pretty sure you'll touch on at least some of them. So
yeah, because what Noah is teasing is that I have a long list of people that I wanted to talk about, because, you know, last year I was very restrained. I usually have a lot of people that I talk about, and last year I was like, I'm going to be respectful. I'm just going to give one choice and then two runners up. And then you guys all had like a list of like seven or eight people. So it was like, screw it. This time I'm going all in. So I got categories. I got different types of things. So Justin, if you're ready for me, I'm just going to launch right into it.
Okay. Let the challenge begin. Three Joes enter, one Joe leaves.
So first of all, starting out with some honorable mentions that didn't make the cut. Most underappreciated comedic performances, I have two. One is Chloe East from The Fabelmans, who is extremely funny in that movie. She steals every scene that she's in. She's sort of the Spielberg counterpart's high school girlfriend, if you will. And she is just very sweet and very funny and just like a real treat in the middle of a movie that oftentimes doesn't feel any of those things. Then also I have to give it up to Austin Abrams from Due Revenge, who does the best Timothée Chalamet impression I've ever seen as his character in this movie, where he plays kind of like this prep school rich kid who looks perfect on paper and is actually maybe a sociopath. And the choice to make that character be essentially Timothée Chalamet analog is perfect, and he nails it perfectly. So props to him on that. Also wanted to give a shout out to two performers who really elevated films that I think were pretty mediocre outside of their performances. One would be Christopher Abbott in On the Count of Three, which is Gerard Carmichael movie from this year. I really like Gerard Carmichael. This movie really kind of meanders and just doesn't really it feels like it's being a lot more profound than it thinks it is, or thinks it's being more profound than it is, I should say. But Christopher Abbott plays Gerard Carmichael's best friend in the movie, and basically the premise of that is that they're both kind of suicidal and they decide that they're going to kill each other that at the end of that day. So this is the last day of their lives, and he goes through quite a journey confronting an abuser of his as a child, played shockingly by Henry Winkler, who is also very good in a role that you wouldn't expect him to be in. He just brings a lot of gravity and a lot of complexity to a role that could have been a kind of wacky side character, and ends up stealing the movie away from Gerard Carmichael, who wrote and directed it in addition to starring in it. So good on him. The other one would be Aubrey Plaza in Emily the Criminal. If you were ever like, what would it be like if Walter White was a 30-year-old woman, then you should watch this movie, because that's essentially what it is. And Aubrey Plaza is incredible in that role, really adding a lot of shades to her persona that you wouldn't have expected. There's a hard edge to her that I've never seen in a performance of hers before that was very interesting and relatable and also somewhat mysterious. And I really think she helped elevate what was a pretty generic script. So good for her on that. Now, also, a couple of people just missed my list of performances, and I wanted to just briefly say, Noah, you already said Viola Davis for The Woman King. Excellent. Every reason why you said, and more. Also,
I mean, how could you not love Viola Davis? It's just,
it was so hard to keep her off my list. It was just, there's just not enough spots. You know, I tried to limit myself to five for best lead actress, and she was literally number six. So still talking about her as a result. The other one would be Kyla Lord Cassidy, who is a supporting actress in The Wonder. The Wonder is a Netflix film by Sebastian Lelio, who is an actor that a director that I really like. This film, I really like it. It's in my top 10 of the year. I think it's really going under noticed and underappreciated, unfortunately. In it, Kyla plays a 11 or 12 year old girl who is in Ireland in like the 1800s and has supposedly stopped eating 4 months ago and is inexplicably still alive and healthy. Florence Pugh plays the lead actress of this film, and she kind of goes in as a nurse to try to investigate what's really going on and to see if this is actually a miracle or if something else is at work. This movie really puts this little girl through the absolute ringer, and she gives a tremendous performance. It's the sort of thing where I'm like, maybe we shouldn't let children act because this seems traumatic. But also she just does an incredible job of playing a very complicated character for a character of that age. And I think she sells it completely. And movie would be much worse if you didn't have a performance in it that was that as strong as this one. So props to her on that, especially since I believe this is like one of her first roles. So those are the honorable mentions. Now, I also had to make, as I said, an exception for some actors because they were great in multiple roles, and it felt wrong to kind of include them outside of that context. So I have a list of four. I've already said Zoe Kravitz in The Batman and Kimmy. Also Florence Pugh, who, as I said, is excellent in The Wonder. Actually, I was talking to someone the other day, and they said that they watched this movie and they felt really like she was kind of like a young Kate Winslet in this role. And that was something that hadn't occurred to me as I was watching it. But after hearing it, I was like, yes, that's exactly the vibe that she's giving off. So and that is a real compliment, you know, considering Kate Winslet, one of the best actresses of her generation. But Florence Pugh may be one of the best of hers, because she also managed to somewhat salvage Don't Worry, Darling, which is objectively not a good movie, but she is great in it. And everyone who watched it said the exact same thing. And that is a testament to her as a performer.
She's the only one who made it out of all that drama with her status intact.
Yeah, if not improved, honestly, given everything that happened.
She rode that pony all the way out into the sea.
Good for her. I cannot wait to see her in the Thunderbolts in a couple years. But until then, we also have, of course, Colin Farrell, who I think gave three of the best performances of the year, not just in The Banshees of Inisherin, where he is heartbreakingly sweet and charming and just perfect, but also in Aftergang, where he is the lead of that movie, and he is really kind of playing this sort of downbeat dad who's just kind of trying to do his best. And it's like weird to think of Colin Farrell being in a role like that, but he totally nails it. And that movie has a particular kind of tone, and he is on that wavelength perfectly the whole time. And also The Batman, where he is playing a completely different part as the Penguin, and looks like you've never seen him before. And he is steals every scene of that movie that he is in, which is saying something given the people that he's acting against. So props to him. And then, of course, the number one actor in multiple roles has to go to Cate Blanchett, who in Tar created Lydia Tar, who is a real person who we all know and appreciate and have been fans of for years. She just so thoroughly captures a human being in all their complexity in a way that is truly remarkable. And when she wasn't doing that, she was also in Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio. And I don't know if you guys are aware that she's in Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio.
That is true. I did know that. I'm glad you're highlighting that performance. I was looking at
Do you know who she plays in Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio?
She's both of the fairies, right?
No, she is not. That is Tilda Swinton, and many people might think, "Oh, this must be the Cate Blanchett performance."
Right.
But it actually is Tilda Swinton. She is not Death.
And she is the Tilda Swinton is Death.
Yeah, because Tilda Swinton is Death and the fair and the Green Fairy. So she's not that. But that is who, when I heard that she was in the movie, I was like, oh, this must be who it is. But it's actually Tilda Swinton. And honestly, like, props to Guillermo del Toro to getting Tilda Swinton and Cate Blanchett in the same movie, because I feel like the world should have.
Oh, wait, no, she was the monkey.
She is. She's a Spazzatura, the monkey.
What a fucking name.
Who does not speak really any lines of human dialogue for the most part. I think there's one sequence where he is marionetting some puppets, and in which case he does use an actual human voice inexplicably. But otherwise, is literally just a monkey the whole time. And I just love that was Cate Blanchett. So good for her. Certainly, Lydia Tarr could never, but Cate Blanchett is down for anything.
Quick side note from that. Just another add on to my list of bad guys getting theirs. I love that Pinocchio went hard on having a sequence where Pinocchio literally shit talks Mussolini to his face. And gets executed for it.
He does get executed. One of the many times that Pinocchio straight up dies in Pinocchio, which is the whole thing. That movie is wild. We haven't talked about it, but it is a wild movie that I think everyone
should
see.
It is an experience.
It's the way that movie ends is just absolutely devastating. If I was a child, I would be inconsolable. But good for them for just doing that to their children audience. But in any case, those are my favorite performers who had multiple roles. Now, I do have a list of my 10 favorite supporting performances. But before I get into that, does anybody want to make any comments or reflections on what I've said so far, so I don't have to keep talking until the audience turns off this podcast?
I have to assume that Christoph Waltz in Pinocchio is going to be one of your top supporting roles. No.
Nope. I mean, Christoph Waltz is just being Christoph Waltz. And at a certain point, you lose credit.
He's been riding that honey train for a while now.
I just love that Noah's like, okay, we're taking bets on like what's actually in the list now because we've heard so many. I'm all ears. I'm really curious about this. So
okay, so I'm pretty proud of this supporting
list. Hit us in the face.
It's, it's a gender neutral list because I do feel a little bit conflicted breaking things down into gender categories because of the current climate, but it is also a good way to try to maximize the amount of people that you're talking about in each group. So I split the difference and I did gender neutral for supporting and then gendered for lead performers. So I don't know, maybe that makes me the worst of both worlds, but here we go. Number 10 in supporting is Maya Hawke in Due Revenge, who has one of the best performances in a teen movie that has like maybe ever existed. You really think that you're getting one sort of performance and she's doing it really well, and then all of a sudden the movie turns and it becomes something else, and it's incredible, and she is incredible, and everyone should go watch this movie for her. Number 9 is Nina Haas in Tar, who is excellent as Lydia Tarr's wife, and very, very interesting scenes that they have together, and it's hard to think of a movie that features more moments of just complete dialogue-free performance where you know exactly what this person is thinking, and not just what they're thinking, but also what this means about the context of a relationship that spans decades. Really impressive what she's able to do. Number 8 is Mark Rylance for Bones and All, for all the reasons that I said earlier. He is tremendous and terrifying and truly unique in his performance. Also want to give a shout out on number 7 to Jovan Adepo in Babylon. He is the structure of Babylon is basically it's about three people, but also Jovan Adepo. And it's a real shame because he kind of steals the movie in the stretches that he's in. And he kind of plays a band leader who gets turned on to Hollywood and tries to make big and eventually kind of walks away from it because he sees how corrosive and toxic it is. And the only sad part about that is that when he walks away from Hollywood, it's about, you know, 2/3 of the way through the movie, maybe even halfway through the movie. And then he just kind of walks away from the movie as well. And it's a shame because he's really captivating performer and is given really interesting material that we just don't have enough time to spend more time with because there's just so much happening. So that's not his fault, and the fact that I kept wanting them to go back to him and see more of him is a real testament to his performance. My next performance is Kiki Palmer in Nope. She is fantastic. She is just like a live wire of charisma in this movie and steals so many scenes. She really is so accessible in a way that you really need someone to be, because, you know, with these movies, the way that they can be with these like alien invasions things and everybody is like portentous and kind of like looking up at the sky, and she just like feels like a real person in the middle of it being like, what the fuck are we doing, get out of here, you know. Or and the choice of being like, well, maybe we can make money off of it, is also feels very relatable. So I really,
her reaction to their triumph at the end is so visceral and satisfying.
Yeah, she's just
that scream she lets out is great.
She's an incredible performer. There's a lot of rumors that like, or not even rumors, just like a fan drive to get her to be cast as Rogue in the X-Men films, and to the point where she actually,
yes, please,
she made a
take my money.
This Halloween, she made an Instagram post of her dressed as Rogue, like doing a little bit of like action with a little bit of VFX stuff in there, just to appease her fans, and it got me on board. I would love to see that happen.
Talk about living your best life.
Absolutely. My next pick is Brandon Gleeson for Banshees of Inisherin. His performance is so great, and his character is kind of bananas, and it's remarkable how emotionally grounded he is in the role. Like on paper, this role shouldn't work at all, and yet there's so much coherence to this human being. Like, you feel the love exuding from him as he's telling Colin Farrell, I never want to see you again. And it's just so, like, the scene where he just is happy and he dances with his dog is one of the sweetest, most beautiful moments in all of cinema this year. And I don't think many performers could really pull that off. It's so, like, vanity free in a way that was beautiful, especially considering the character that he's playing could be fairly accused of being quite vain. So I think it's a remarkable performance in that respect.
Yeah, and that scene of him dancing with his dog is followed by one of the funniest line deliveries of the whole year. It got the whole audience howling that we saw it with. And Colin Farrell's just like, you know, there's two sides to this. He's like, no, there isn't. Yeah, you know, it takes two to tango. You have to have two people to dance in this. And he's like, I don't want to dance. You were just dancing with the fucking dog. The whole theater broke up. It was great.
Yeah.
And I have to say, one of my favorite transitions in any movie this year was, I forget what it cuts from, but it's after he is, you know, done a certain thing to himself. and it's him at the pub leading the musicians. The entire table is covered in blood, and he's just stabbing his violin in the air to direct them.
It's just, it, as we're describing this, like, it is, it's something that just should not work. And he just manages to play so many different levels that it just
can only be Brendan Gleeson.
It's really a remarkable achievement. Justin, do you want to talk about that for a second? I know you love this movie as well.
I do. I think I mean, and there's so many good performances in it, but yeah, I just to talk about Brendan Gleeson for a second, it's just the real sense of like just the weight of the world on this person, even if it's self-imposed. I mean, like you said, I think like there is like a vanity there, but there is a real soulfulness too. And you know, I think maybe some of the things that his character is experiencing, maybe like Carrie Condit's character has been experiencing, and it's just showing how they're like remarkably different approaches for these people, even though they may feel some similar things. And I just think he really captures that really well. And also just, this is such a, like, you know, to speak to just the two of them, like, I just love this as a kind of like counter programming to their rapport in Bruges. I just think that's a really inspired choice. I'm sure they were aware of that as they were doing this. I'm sure McDonough did it very intentionally. I just love it. And I just love the fact that it's that the two of them again, but it really doesn't feel like they're ever repeating themselves. So really, yeah, just a really just no. Great casting. You know, great actors. It just, everything's working.
These are two very different characters than the world-weary hitman from In Bruges.
Yes, yeah. And rightfully so. My next one is my number four in my supporting performance list is Brian Tyree Henry in the movie Causeway, which is most notable for being the reason why Jennifer Lawrence was in interviews that are went viral on YouTube over the last few months. But it is actually a movie that's quite good, actually. It's in my top 20 of the year. It's really, really good, much better than I expected it to be based on how it's been received, in my opinion. But one of the reasons why it's so great is because Brian Tyree Henry is there playing a man that Jennifer Lawrence becomes friends with along the way. The movie is about Jennifer Lawrence is a veteran who has suffered a traumatic brain injury overseas, and she's come back home to try to kind of like recover and restart her life. And Brian Tyree Henry is this man who like she meets by happenstance, who becomes friends with her, and they realize that they have a lot in common. And it's just one of these movies that's just a couple of people in scenes, really intimate character work, connections being explored, and he is just so present and so specific and plays so many different tones and textures to this character that he just really like warms your heart. And it's just a great showcase for what he can do as an actor that is in some ways similar but in some ways very different to what he does on the television show Atlanta, and you know, pretty different from his role as Fastos in Eternals. he did not cause you know, Hiroshima in this movie, thankfully, but he did win my heart. So he is my number four and also my highest ranking male performer in the supporting category. Ladies have it as they have with your categories as well, because that's how it always seems to be. Stephanie Hsu is my number three for Everything Everywhere All at Once. She is tremendous in this movie. She has to do so many different things in this movie. She has to be so many different people. She was honestly, I almost put her on my list of best villains list, because she certainly plays that role perfectly for a while in the film, but I feel like that would do a disservice to what she's doing. I think her connection to Michelle Yao, both in the main timeline and also in the sort of multiversal essence of who she is really tremendous. And I think that she is, you know, I've loved that she's been getting a lot of nominations, and I just really can't wait to see what she does in the future. So I think she's just a tremendous performer, and I really found myself in her in a lot of the scenes in a way that really spoke to me and helped make those emotional moments really work in a way that was really impressive. Number two is Carrie Condon, which Noah has already talked about and Justin has talked about and everyone should More continue Sherry. To talk about. She's fucking amazing. And my number one she's fucking amazing. So but my best supporting performance is Tong Wei for Decision to Leave. She is a fantastic actress. I've loved her for a long time. Her role in Les Caution is unbelievable. And here she plays someone entirely different. She plays this sort of character that you can never quite pin down, even when she's kind of like confessing her soul to someone. There's always that thing in the back of your head where you're like, maybe this is all still kind of a put on, at least for a while. And yeah, she is just, she has to be incredibly captivating, incredibly idiosyncratic, and like beguiling in a way that feels so lived in. And she does that without it ever feeling like the film is being exploitative or overly sexualizing her or making her or objectifying her in any way. She feels like such a force to be reckoned with throughout the whole film. And it's really impressive what she pulls off. And again, also manages the kind of complicated tone that this movie is going for, where sometimes it's wacky and silly and sometimes it's tortured and romantic and sometimes it's a tense thriller. And she just hits every scene perfectly out of the park, and you completely get why the things happen the way that they do, which I won't spoil, but yeah, a fantastic performance.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it. And even just like the way you're describing it, it's like, it reminds me of like other like great femme fatale performances that I think of, like, you know, Mary Astor in the Maltese Falcon, for example. Like, it is always that you're never quite sure. Even when things are revealed, you're still not quite sure. Like, yeah. That's a really great, you know, I think when those kinds of roles are really done well, then it really feels like these are actual human beings with all the complications that we, you know, that we expect. So,
yeah, and that's absolutely how it felt. Okay, now I'm going to go into my lead actress category, which, with Cate Blanchett absent from it, we're going to start with Anna Diop from Nanny, which is a film that is currently available on Prime Video. A movie that kind of did well at Sundance, but I feel like kind of had its release come and go and not many people talked about. A lot of people were like, well, it's supposed to be a horror movie, it's not that scary. I didn't find it to be a horror movie at all. I found it to be a really interesting film that delves into kind of like magical realism and some surrealist qualities that's all about the kind of like alienation of a person, an immigrant, a mother who is out without her child, trying to live in a world that is completely separate from her own in a lot of ways, and trying to like puncture through the bullshit of it and also find a way to exist inside of it. And it definitely has some things in common to Roma, but in very different film in a lot of ways. And I think Anna Diop's performance is really captivating, really spellbinding, really emotionally accessible. You feel angry when she feels angry, you feel distraught when she feels distraught. It's like an incredibly empathetic performance with emotionally accessible performance that I think people are sleeping on. Really, really good. Next one is Tilda Swinton in 10,000 Years of Longing, movie that doesn't totally work, but she is
3,000. It's 3,000 Years of
Longing.
Oh, yes.
Well,
mentioning this. I was wondering if you would have a chance to bring up this film.
After watching the film, it felt like 10,000 years, but but not because of Tilda Swinton, who really is so fun and so smart and sharp and tender and emotionally provocative in this film. And there's some wild shit that goes on, and the whole time the only thing that you really have to hold on to is the fact that Tilda Swinton feels so incredibly like a real person who you would run into on a college campus somewhere and that you could believe would actually have this experience. I really think this movie just doesn't work at all without her in it. And it's questionable whether it works in the first place, but it definitely is doing as much as it is because she's there.
It is a different kind of romance. This movie is doing a lot of things differently, including with her character and her performance. It's amazing how she makes you believe that she's this very odd kind of oddball, you know, college professor. And then you're like, no, but I guess she would fall in love with like an immortal genie and convince him to like take her as her as his lover. And of course it would be Idris Elba. Who else?
Yeah, I mean, listen, if Idris Elba came to me and was like, I'm an immortal genie and we should get married, I'd be like, okay, fine, I get it.
I think everyone would say that, like, completely separate from gender and sexual identity. Like, that's one of the rules in the book.
If nothing else, this film is very well cast. And I think Tilda Swinton elevates the material that is sort of all over the place without her grounding the center of it.
It's everything and everywhere.
almost. It's almost Everything Everywhere. My next one is Regina Hall for Honk for Jesus, Save Your Soul. Regina Hall is an actress that I'm a huge fan of. I've been supporting her for years. She also had a movie that got a lot of noise out of Sundance called Master, which I watched and thought she was good in, but I thought it was kind of a mess of a movie, and it didn't really let her do as much as she could have done, I think, in that role. But this movie, on the other hand, is also kind of messy in the sense that it's, you think that you're getting a mockumentary about a kind of a pastor, megachurch guy who's trying to revive his career, but it actually is a lot more serious than that in a lot of scenes. It's very kind of emotionally impactful and devastating, actually, and actually it shifts between the documentary and a more practical style of shooting the film, where you're outside of what's going on with the documentary as well, which was an interesting choice that I don't know if it totally worked. But what did work is Regina Hall at the center of the film, because she is, I think, just, she balances all of the different tones so effectively. She can play the comedic scenes effortlessly. And when the movie gives her moments where she has to play the quiet indignity of being the wife of a disgraced pastor who's stuck with him, she just breaks your heart, and she really just owns the screen and is just incredible. I really think that people are sleeping on this performance. It's sad to me, because I think that some of the things that are being highlighted this year aren't even close to how good she is in this movie. There's a scene late in the movie where she has to, in full mime makeup, have one of the most devastating conversations about a relationship and about like her life and her integrity, and it should be impossible to nail, because it's just objectively ridiculous and also incredibly serious at the same time. And she is the perfect performer to do both of those things at once, and it's a fantastic performance. My next one is Margot Robbie in Babylon. Margot Robbie is electric in this movie. She plays this sort of like up and coming starlet in the 1920s silent movie era, breaking into the spoken era of film. She starts this film breaking into a crazy backstage Hollywood party, just dancing on the tables, being so undeniably charismatic that she gets cast in a film just from across the room, because they're like, who is this girl? We got to get her in a movie. Also because the person who they needed to play that role died in the at the party, as it turned out, which is kind of the vibe of this movie. It captures both things perfectly, right? It's this kind of like your dream comes true. Somebody spots you at a party and casts you, but also it's happening because a girl just like you overdosed a couple minutes earlier. That's kind of like this movie in a nutshell. And she owns that brilliantly. She is just the most charismatic person on the planet in this film, and she is heartbreaking.
I mean, you just
she
described
vulnerable.
All of her movies, so you got to narrow it down a bit, Alex.
It's just such helping. It's such a great distillation of what, and it's hard to call this a distillation because it's like a 3-hour movie, but of what she does so fantastically. And like some of the scenes kind of go off the rails a little bit. Some of them are like overly indulgent, sure, but that none of that is Margot Robbie's fault. She is perfect in every scene that she's in, and her exit in this film will stick with me forever. It's just one of the most beautiful scenes I've seen on screen. So I love her in this movie, and it's a shame that not enough people have seen this film, because it's worth seeing, if not just for her. And my number one is Michelle Yeoh in Everything Everywhere All at Once. There's no suspense to that at all. If I was trying to decide between Michelle Yeoh and Cate Blanchett, it would be really difficult. But luckily, I constructed things so I don't need to, and so therefore she gets it. And she's perfect for all the reasons we already said, so I won't bore you. But I mean, it's just a tremendous performance. She talks all the time in interviews about how this role made her cry, because it like made her feel like this, finally someone is giving her a chance to show off all of the different things that she can do, that she could be more than just the stoic action hero. She can be funny. She could be vulnerable. She could be romantic. She could be a mess, you know, and this movie lets her be all of those things all of the time. And she is always incredible. So I'm so happy for her. And I hope that she gets more roles that show off all of the variety of things she's capable of doing. But if Hollywood continues to be awful and she never gets that chance again, at least we have this as a document of what an incredible achievement of acting she was able to pull off in 19 days. Just remarkable. Before I move on to my lead actors, does anyone want to talk about what we've discussed so far?
Now I'm just thinking about Michelle Yeoh. So,
yeah. It's really like it's one of those things where I feel like she's such an she's so incredible that I wasn't surprised she could deliver something like this. It was more like, oh, where has this been? Like, I've just been waiting for this opportunity for her. So it was really satisfying watching that movie and finally seeing it happen. And I'll just say, like, there are moments in that movie where, like, I'm not even thinking about Michelle Yeoh like as Michelle Yeoh. Like, I'm really invested in this character, Evelyn. And she gets to do a lot of different things. Like, there's times where she really is playing into like more of that star persona, but there always is this kind of grounding to everything she's doing. And it really feels like a proper performance. And I just really am happy that it's things are happening for her. Love seeing Jamie Lee Curtis being her cheerleader in award season. Can we get more of that, please?
Like, I'm just gonna want Jamie Lee Curtis. I mean,
she's not only her cheerleader in award season, but also, of course, her beloved hot dog hand spouse in portions of this movie.
Yes. Well, that goes without saying.
I mean, this was obviously,
does it go without saying?
If she's nominated for the Academy Award, that has to be the scene that they show, right?
I certainly hope so. I don't know. Oh, well, I mean, I think the Wong Kar Wai ode is what they should show, because that is just maybe the most beautiful part of the movie and where she is so graded. But yeah, I mean, you could show, if you had to limit it to one scene, you would only get like a 16th of what this movie asks her to do. So it's really.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Stella and I every year when the nominations come out, we'll try to guess which scenes they'll pick to show. Most of the time, we're completely off the mark, but sometimes we get it right.
And then sometimes the show runs long and they don't air the scenes at all. And that's kind of like what's happening here. So instead of talking in depth about all of my best lead actor nominees, I'm just going to list them off. And that includes number 5, Jack Loudon for Benediction. He's fantastic in a movie that really needs him to be. Daniel Kaluuya in Nope is number 4. He is just always fantastic, and he's perfect here playing OJ of all people. I love that that Jordan Peele was like, I want to bring the name OJ back into culture in a positive way.
He has the most expressive eyes.
It's true. And also, just, like, he could just be just his eyes shift, like he can shift his eyes in a way where you just feel like in this movie you're just like, he's so emotionally accessible and you just like, he's a hero. And then a shot in Get Out makes him feel like this just like incredible victim of like horror that you're just like, you want to save and you feel so horrible for. And then in Widows he seems like just like a stone cold monster, and it's all just with close-ups of his face, which is just, I mean, yes, that's acting, but most actors can't do that. So I love the range. Someone who hasn't gotten a chance to show a lot of range, because this is, I think, one of his very first performances, but he's off to a great start in my book, and that's Banks Rapetta, who is the lead of Armageddon Time. He is like a 13-year-old boy, but he is really good in this movie, much better than you would expect him to be, and he needs to be, because this movie really rests on his shoulders in a lot of ways, and he gets to be like charming and cute and like adorable little kid stuff, but also like kind of a bastard sometimes and kind of an asshole in the way that those kids that age can be. And he like knows how to torture people, and he knows how to manipulate people, but he also knows how to like love people. And like, really in the middle of all this, he doesn't really know himself at all. And I think that he really captures that really well. And he is kind of the proxy to James Gray, who is director of this movie. And I think it must have been really intimidating to be the childhood self of the director every day on set. And I think he did a really great job of embodying that character. Similar to my number 2, which is Gabriel LaBelle for The Fabelmans, who played a young Steven Spielberg. There were a lot of these movies this year, and they did feature really great performances. Gabriel LaBelle played a teenage Spielberg, and he just was Steven Spielberg. Like, he felt so much like him. It was remarkable. And also, he had to really stand shoulder to shoulder to some of the best actors that we have, you know, like with Paul Dano and Michelle Williams and Seth Rogen and all these people. And he had to be so, like, he got a lot of really difficult things to do, and he did a really great job. But I said I wouldn't talk very long about these, so I'm going to go straight to my number one, because Colin Farrell is not eligible for this, and that is Austin Butler for Elvis. Say what you will about Elvis as a film, but you cannot deny that
a brave
Austin
choice.
Butler gave an incredible physical, like, whole body and soul performance. He left it all on the screen. It was a remarkable transformation. This is a guy who was best known before this as like a Disney Nickelodeon sitcom star. When he was cast, everybody was like, what? That's who they're getting for Elvis? That's insane. And then we saw it, and it's truly the performance of a career. It may have broken him because he now can't stop talking in an Elvis accent for some reason, but it's worth it because it was just an incredible, incredible performance. Just the he was playing a person who had to be, who is like literally historic for how charismatic he is on stage. And he pulled it off. He just did. And it's remarkable. And he sung the songs and he did the dances, and he had to be in these super like overheated scenes of melodrama with the other characters. He had to find a way to relate to Tom Hanks dressed like that with that voice. And he pulled it off.
Yeah, so I was going to say, how is it that Tom Hanks was not on your top villains list? I demand a recount.
Because it's a terrible performance. That's why, Noah. In a movie I genuinely like, he is terrible in it. No disrespect for Tom Hanks. I love him very much. But my God, what the fuck was happening? But Austin Butler was not deterred. He made this movie.
Alex, he was reaching for eternity.
This was not a great year for Tom Hanks, the character actor, I have to say.
Listen, he was recovering from COVID throughout most of these performances, true. So I think we just got to give him the benefit of the doubt, right?
Everyone Rita deserves. Does that also include?
Was he also recovering from COVID when he agreed to be in a Disney live-action movie?
I think he did that as a favor to his friend, you know, that did not go well. But they did him a favor by only releasing that on Disney Plus. So, in any case. Austin Butler, Elvis, no one is more surprised than me that I think it's one of the best performances of the year. So very, very excited. So as a recap of my number one in all of these categories, we have best performer with multiple roles goes to Cate Blanchett, but runner up is Colin Farrell. Best supporting performance goes to Tong Wei. Best lead actress, Michelle Yeoh, and best lead actor, Austin Butler for Elvis.
Tune in next week where the Academy fails to honor any of these people.
I mean, you know, some of these people actually have legitimate chances of
definitely
going to get nominated, yeah. And some have legitimate chances of winning. So
no,
it's
joke.
A surprisingly good year in that respect.
Front runner for best actress at this point. Like, definitely.
What'd you say?
I would say Yao is definitely the front runner for best actress at this point.
Well, she's not the front. It's between her and Cate Blanchett, and it's going to be really close. But we can talk about that next month. This month was all about our opinions, not about the Oscars.
Thank God.
So I've just talked for like 35 minutes. So please rescue me from myself.
I'm actually going to, you know, Alex, you and I saw Elvis together, you know, you were a much bigger fan of it than I was, but we can't,
yeah.
Like, I cannot deny how good Austin Butler is. And it's like, not having known him from the Disney Channel stuff, my familiarity with him was Tex Watson in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where the only thing I really remember is him having his genitalia mutilated by a pit bull. Like, that's the last thing I remember. So to see this, it was like a completely new person to me.
Lovely.
And
lovely.
Yeah, I know. Yep.
Not
the fair part of that movie.
I mean, is it worse than cutting off your own fingers and using them to kill a miniature donkey?
I mean to kill the miniature donkey.
That's true. Right.
Oh, I have to note on that note, when we saw Inisherin, yeah. Again, the crowd was into it. Like it was a big theater, maybe half full. People were reacting to the movie. There's a bunch of people behind us who, at the end of the movie, I just hear this the girl complaining to the guy in German. Every time I let you talk me into seeing a movie, a pony or a donkey dies in a horrible way. I'm never going to a movie theater with you again. I am traumatized.
Somebody recently watched EO, apparently.
It was, I think that's the other movie she was talking about, actually. Yeah. I think she was joking. I think. But it was a wonderful codex to the experience.
Wow.
It's the perfect experience, add on to the credits. And so I would like
Jenny, she's a legend.
I oh my god, when he puts the cross in the ground and he wrote her name with the hearts, like, how sweet, but also how fucking sad, man.
That is.
But also when he's just like, I'm depressed, I'm letting the donkey in the house. When I'm depressed, you can't make me not let have the donkey in here. It was just like an amazing moment.
It's like, but you're Irish, you're depressed every day. He's like, exactly. I do have to say, we did not mention, so, well, we didn't talk that much on the cast of Wakanda Forever, except for Jose Huerta Mejia, and rightfully so. Like, he's one of the names that I wrote down as someone I wanted to talk about.
Tenacuerta.
I do want to give a shout out to Winston Duke, because I really appreciate what he's doing in both Black Panther movies. He's, you know, physically, his voice, how he says his lines, how he carries himself, feels like he should be a classic head up his ass, macho, like, toxic piece of shit. But he really is not. Like, he is present and does the right thing at some really key emotional moments in both movies. And I think he is... like, a lot of people have been like praising him and his character in the movies. I feel like he's gotten more respect as comic relief than he has for like the emotional weight that he's carrying, even if it's a small amount. And he's obviously not the lead of either of these movies. I really appreciate his character and what he's doing in these movies. Also, shout out to Angela Bassett and Letitia Wright, who really do carry Wakanda Forever just to an amazing degree.
Angela Bassett was a hard person to leave off my list of supporting performances.
Yeah, that was my big surprise. That
it was.
Yeah, I mean, Wakanda Forever, another great ensemble, and also so many individual performances that you can pick out. Yeah, those are the ones that I had. Okay, also Janelle Monáe in Glass Onion is just. I mean, it's a fun cast, but her character, well, both of her characters, really.
She's a movie star. Like, you watch that you watch that and you're like, oh, this is a movie star. I can't wait to watch a million movies starring her in the future.
Yeah, no. She, Anna de Armas, and Daniel Craig can team up just for every movie for the rest of time in my book. And I'd be sold.
Yeah, we'll have to wait to see what the next Knives Out sequel brings us.
Stephanie Shu should be the co-lead with Daniel
Craig. Final words, Justin?
No, I think honestly, I feel like we've pretty much I feel like we've covered the entire year, even beyond.
We're not quite at Avatar's run. We're not quite at Avatar runtime, guys. I think we can squeeze another hour out of this.
We could do another hour.
We definitely could. I will not. I will cede the floor.
Fair enough.
But guys, this was a real treat. I love hearing like what, because it's like with Alex is like, I'm able to follow your letterbox and kind of know like what you've been seeing. But like, it's really good to hear you talk about the performances to know like what really stuck with you. And no, it's like completely new to me, just even figuring out like what you've seen. So we've done it. Another year in the books. So let's talk about where we can find everybody. And Noah, we'll start with you. Where can we find you online?
All right. Well, as we've been hinting at a little bit, and as regular listeners will know, Justin and I, in addition to our work here, we have a couple of music podcasts that we also do, a finished series called Pod on the Rooftops, where we talk about our favorite band, Genesis, and a current ongoing series called The Rush Hour, where we go through the discography of another.
The Rush Hour.
Right. Sorry, I forgot. Got to have the full title in there. Where we go through the discography of another favorite band of ours, Rush. And for me personally, I am still currently on Twitter. I'm holding on by the skin of my teeth. And you can also find my written stuff at francenoir.blogspot.com.
And I just wanted to mention, too, that the two podcasts you mentioned, they're part of the Pop Break Today podcast feed. So you can find us there. So thank you for plugging that, Noah. You can find me at other places on thecinemaverick.com. That's my website. I'm also on Letterboxd at The Cinemaverick. You can look on my website. I will have my best of 2021 by the time this is posted. So you can see what I liked from that year. And then I'll get started. I'm very diligent, even though it takes me forever. I will have a 2022 list at some point, and I will have seen many more movies, I'm sure, by then. Alex, where can we find you online?
Oh, the places you can find me. Okay, so I am the editor of popbreak.com, their podcasts. So you can definitely check out the podcast section to see all the podcasts that I'm producing. We have a couple of different feeds running. I have podcasts on two of them. So Popbreak TV, you can subscribe to, where you can hear a wide variety of shows, including mine, TV Break, which we did a year in review for television that aired in December. So if you have had your fill of movie talk from me and want to hear what I thought about the year in television, along with my co-hosts Bill Bodkin and Josh Chernacki, you can go on over there. We also have an episode in this month, January, where we discussed all of the things in 2023 that we're looking forward to in the world of television. So that was a fun episode as well. You can also subscribe to Pop Break Today, which was previously The Breakcast. We have renamed that feed to Pop Break Today. We had a fancy new logo and everything. On that, when you're done listening to my co-host's music podcast, you can listen to Bill versus the MCU, where last year I spent all 12 months rewatching every single movie and TV show in the MCU and talking about it three or four entries at a time. In December, we had a big award show, the Feigies, where we got to deliver some standard awards like favorite performances and favorite movies and trilogies, but also some non-standard awards like the Tom's Tears Awards for moments that made us cry, and other things like that. So definitely check that out. We're about to launch our new season where we're going to be spending the next 6 months covering Marvel's Defenders Verse, which were the shows that aired on Netflix, including Daredevil, Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, all that stuff. So first episode out the gate is going to be on Daredevil season one. So you can check that out and you can watch along if you're interested. In addition to all of that, I had the pleasure of guesting on David Rosen's podcast, Piecing It Together, where we talked about a movie that did not come up in 2.5 hours on this podcast, White Noise, which is the latest Noah Baumbach movie. That is a really fun podcast where we talk about what we see as the cinematic inspiration for the film that we're discussing. And we come up with all of the puzzle pieces that helped come together to make that movie what it was. And it's a really fun discussion. So definitely check that out where you find podcasts. That's Piecing It Together. Together podcast is the name of that one. So, and yeah, you can also follow CinemaJoes on Twitter at CinemaJoes for updates on the latest episodes. You can follow me at Media Thinkings on Twitter and Letterboxd. Twitter, I'm just posting links when I post new stuff. So if you're having a hard time keeping track of what I'm doing and where I'm doing it, that's a good place to follow, even if I'm not doing a lot of engagement there these days. Letterboxd, as I spent the last 3 weeks of the year watching a tremendous amount of films, and you can see what I thought about all of them in bite-sized reviews over there on Letterboxd.
Great, and thank you again for plugging all of our things here at Cinema Joes, Alex, and I look forward to checking out more, especially Bill vs. MCU. I've been really enjoying that a lot, if I can plug one of my co-hosts here at the end of the show. We want to thank our listeners as well. Thank you for sticking with us, and we'll be bringing you more stuff. So thank you, and this is Justin Mancini signing off.